Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Morelia Python Radio. Tonight we have Mr. Nick Mutton joining us, and we're going to be talking about Liasis. And then at the end of the, I guess the second half of the show, we're going to be talking about becoming a full-time breeder. And what it takes.
Maybe I'll learn.
Yeah. Some of the things that, you would need to know before doing that undertaking. But we are brought to you by Morelia Python's forum. That's www.moreliapythons.com. While we wait for Nick to call in, just a couple of things that I want to hit on. I guess first and foremost, did you see that they have a new president of USARC? Phil, I think his last name is Goss. Apparently he's a long time herper, and he's been in the industry for about 15 years, and from what I've seen, there seems to be a lot of positive vibes about him, so we shall see.
That's a good thing. My vote was going to be for Sean Havlick. If that had ever come up, I would have just been like, yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Sean is super passionate. I remember he was a great guest on the show.
Mm-hmm. We should have him on again.
Yeah. I heard a radio show the other day with Greg Graziani, and apparently this is kind of upsetting, but I don't know if I heard this wrong, but they were saying that the python hunters, they're trying to come up with a new show to where they're going out and killing the pythons, sort of along the lines of the Rattlesnake Republic type of thing. And, you know, I think about it, and the more and more of these, you know, now Nat Geo Wild's going to go down the way of
Animal Planet
and not show anything about animals. I mean, it's such,
Animal Planet,
it's such BS,
is,
man.
Animal Planet has every animal show is about either people killing animals or animals killing people, and then there's a bunch of dumbasses running around the woods looking for Sasquatch. And I'm like, really? This is what we've become.
Yeah, I know. It's a shame.
Those people infuriate me. I can't. If you were to put me in a room with those people and tell them they need to convince me of the existence of Sasquatch, I would be the only one leaving the room because I would have killed everybody else just 10 minutes in.
That's awesome.
I'm sorry, I had to get that off my chest.
I'm going to invite Bobo to Carpet Fest and have
shut that up. Shut that up. I'll murder him in full view of the public. There will be so many witnesses. It'll be crazy.
That's great. That's awesome.
Sorry, I need to get that off my chest. Apparently, I've been holding on to that one.
Yeah, apparently you don't like the Bigfoot people. Okay.
No, fucking idiot.
All right. Of course, we have the two polls
on that bombshell
brought to you by CB Reptiles. The first one was what do you clean with? And it looks like the hands down winner was the bleach and water combo.
Yeah, that's what I use.
Yeah, I kind of go back and forth. I use the blue stuff for a while. Sometimes I use the bleach and water. I don't even know how to. I have no idea. I'm not good at stuff.
I've used Joy soap because I figure if it's safe to like clean ducklings and seals after an oil spill, it should be good for the snakes. I mean, they'll be okay.
Well, that's good that you're really thinking it through there, Owen. That's pretty good.
No, not really. It was right there, so I used it, and then nothing died, so it was okay.
Yeah. And then the other question, we had two questions this week, I guess, and then the other one was, are you for hybridizing carpets? Now, I kind of got confused on this because when I hear
integrating is different. You think integrating and hybridizing.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, they were kind of going with the whole would you breed a chondro to a carpet. I say,
never.
No, I would not.
No.
And I'm the Frankenstein morph guy. And
you are.
I would
you're
not.
All, but you're all integrated. Like, you know, I want you to know, the first person who ever finds a way to breed a rough scale to a jag is going to find me on their front doorstep with a shotgun. So,
yeah,
and I bet you I can get a few other people to come with me.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of a weird thing for me, but you have to have, in order for something to be a project for worth me doing, there has to be a reason behind it for making, making that morph look better. But,
agreed.
You know, even with IJ Jags, I mean, I like IJ Jags, but for some reason it's
not that much different.
Yeah, it doesn't really.
No.
What's the point? You know what I mean? I'd like IJs much better, so I would much, you know, rather do it. But that's me, you know. So I call myself a fence guy. You know, I sit on the fence. I'm happy. I sit on the fence. I like the pure stuff. You know, and with no morphs and nothing like that, and I like the, of course, I like all the morphs and mixing it all up, so.
Mm-hmm. You tend to sit on the fence on a lot of things. I mean, you know, the I'm a dark sider with light side tendencies and da-da-da-da. Like, here I am trying to please everybody. But no,
not so much that.
I would never.
Go ahead.
No, I would never consider, like, listen, I know that everybody's animals are their own, and everybody's going to do what they want to do, and I know that the drive for mixing some of these hybrids is, I think it would be a very cool looking animal. You're right, it could be, but it just what are you doing? It's why?
Yeah.
And it's like the guys who are breeding like ball pythons to everything that is a python. Why? Just tell me why. Because like there's no point, there's no market, there's no nothing. And they could even say that by crossing, like there was that zebra, I'm sorry, there was that spider jag, which was they took an IJ jag to a spider ball python. And the animal, you could say, looked interesting, but it had such problems. It was insane.
I wonder if they got dead Lucy's from that.
I don't know.
Because the spider's pretty similar
jag. Spider is the ball python version of the jag, yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Yeah. Nick would probably know. So, just like, why? It makes no sense to me. But other people are like, oh, people want it because it'll look cool, and it's almost seems to be sometimes it's purely money driven.
Come on, man, you can't tell me that they can't make that look like that with all the ball python morphs that are out there in the world.
Jesus fucking Christ, there's like purple ones with yellow dots. Yeah. You can't do something better.
Take a step back and do some selective breeding, for Christ's sake. Jesus, you know, I mean, come on, think about it, and then put it together. And I'm sure you could make a snake look like that without mixing up the species.
But then there's also the, like, think about it with other things like the Colleen's pythons. Was that just because they had a breeder male Bolens and were just trying to get some money out of it? Because they were able to sell the Colleen's babies. So,
yeah, I mean,
got a Bolens, it's working.
To me, if I don't know. I just, hey, look, and I'm like you. You do whatever you want to do, but, you know, I think
you're
about.
Stay away from mine, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. But as far as like the whole sitting on the fence is, you know, the whole thing with that is just I appreciate the carpet python complex and Morelia in general, just for what it is. I really, really am passionate. Oh, there you go. Drink them up.
Tough drink. Yes, that done drink. Yeah, I was waiting for it. I had it. I was like, come on. Done.
I mean, it's my favorite complex of pythons, and I just love them all. I can appreciate the beauty in them all. You know, from the natural occurring snake as it is in the wild, all the way up to the, you know, Frankenstein morph that can be created. But, you know.
And that's the thing, is I think that most of the people who are going to do hybridizing of these animals don't have a select complex or group of or family or species or whatever you want to call it, like the pythons, that they're really, really attached to. They're kind of like the people who do the hybridization, I think, in the most part, are everything kind of guys. They have a bunch of everything, and they're just breeding to sell, and they got these two together, and they're breeding them, and they come out with some funky-looking babies that they'll sell.
Right.
Because some Joe Schmo is going to think that's awesome-looking and that they can breed it themselves.
Right.
Yeah.
So, well, that's our stance on that.
Yes.
Because,
I mean, there was one show, it was one time I was at a reptile show, and we brought our black-faced white lips to show off, and somebody's like, oh, man, I had one of those. I tried breeding it to my Woma, and I had to, like, hold Chris.
What?
I swear to God. Someone's like, we have one of those. We tried breeding it to our Woma, and I had to hold Chris, like, by the collar of his shirt. He's going to dive over the table. Why? All I could muster to say was, what? Why? He's like, oh, man, I'm telling you, those iridescents and that color would have been great. I'm like, it's a black snake. You would have gotten, the polar opposites, blacks and then tans and then a short face and a long snout. What the fuck are you doing?
Oh, jeez.
You know.
Well,
yeah,
speaking of morphs, Ollie from Precision, he posted up a pretty cool thread of the latest combos and updates of the stuff that he had. He had an Exanic Zebra, which was pretty cool. He had the Caramel Granite, and that yellow really comes through, especially compared to the normal-looking one that you can see. And it had red eyes. That was pretty cool. I really like that.
That is awesome looking, yeah.
The sun glow. I love that orange head on that thing.
Yeah.
That was pretty wild. And the Exanic Zebra Jack, probably my favorite.
I like the Exanic Zebra Jack.
Man, that really cleaned it up.
Anyway, yeah.
Crisp, nice. Yeah, really dug it.
Yeah.
And then the Caramel Granite Jag was pretty cool. I like that, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was on that.
Of course, you're like, I have all of these now. They're on their way. Yada, yada, yada.
Well, speaking of that, my Caramel Girl.
I don't want to talk about it. Shut up.
Caramel Head Albino, I believe, is Gravit. I believe she's Gravit. Yeah.
Joy of joys.
Yeah, so it's a possibility, pretty, pretty strong possibility of some sun glows.
So what have we learned?
What?
What will we have ready?
Oh, that's already ready. The incubator?
Oh, the incubator's already ready? Yeah, you sure?
Yeah.
Okay.
I told you that, like...
I'm going to keep mine.
Keep yours on just in case.
Forgive me if I don't believe you. I'm just going to plug mine in now.
Yeah, plug
it
in.
By the way, the price for using my incubator this year is going to have to be your Halmahera. So...
Oh, that's not going to happen.
I will incubate them myself.
Or I'll run on a treadmill to keep the electricity going in my house if it goes out in order to keep that from happening. So yeah, that's pretty much what I got going on. I think the zebra head albino might be Gravit too.
Nice.
Yeah, she's like laying on her side and.
I think my tiger jag got my red girl. She's laying funky, and then I think Talon got the monster, so
yeah.
I think Sophie's going to lay eggs this year, which, what have I done?
Yeah, oh no.
Get 52 eggs again, and then the red tiger looks like she's taken too, so.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I got my red tiger together too.
Nice.
Yeah, so.
Well, I'll break you red tigers.
Yeah, I told you everybody that the tiger, it happened to me again this year, where the tiger that I thought was a
girl
male
turned into a boy.
turned out to be, our female turned out to be a boy, but he's getting it on with the my Michael Pinnell Coastal, so Tiger to Michael Pinnell Striped Coastal.
I think that's here. They're gorgeous.
They're going to be really nice, yeah.
So
that's cool.
I may need to steal your panel boy at one point to throw with my panel girl just because he's so pretty. So
that's a before we get Nick on, because he's on the line there, I just wanted to hit on. There goes a perfect example of what I'm talking about. You know, to me, a Michael Pinnell Coastal, and I have a one that came from Nick, too, and they have very, very specific looks to them. And to me, they're perfect just the way they are. You know, I wouldn't breed them to Jags or anything like that, because I just like the whole, just to refine the stripe and outcrossed it, or put it with the Tiger, and, you know, just keep them within the Coastal thing, you know. The one I got from Nick is, and then I have another one that came from Blake Bauer, their 08s, and that one has a lot of orange in it. I've never seen one like that, but definitely a cool Coastal. They came as a pair, two females that I got a while back, a long time ago. And, yeah, so I just really dig, like, just the pure Coastal. I just think they're awesome. But.
So you wouldn't take a panel and cross it to your zebra?
No. No.
Oh, thank God.
No.
Okay, I'd have to take it from you.
See, that, you know, I have snakes for that. I bought specific projects to breed, you know, those animals too. I mean, to me, you know, Nick and Mike, they've spent the years refining their lines, and, you know, I just want to continue to try to.
Yeah, no point in mucking it up. Yeah.
They're beautiful.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
What's
the point? I'm not about to start crossing my panel with anything else other than to the sun, which is, like, unless I choose it, I mean, not about to go, hey, you know what would be great? A panel granite.
Yeah, and I think that's what drives me away from the whole not that I don't like jungles, but kind of what makes me like IJs and Coastals is the fact that if people would just refine it as much as they have with the jungles, which I mean they have, and you can see, but it seems for some reason, obviously black and yellow is, I mean, that catches your eye, there's no doubt
gorgeous.
About it, you know what I mean? But
I do. I
guarantee that you could do the same thing within any species in the complex of carpet pythons, and I think there needs to be more of that done. So, all right, I'm getting off my egg crate here and stepping down, and I'm going to click Nick on and get some liasis talk. You ready? Anything else you want to head on?
No. Go. I need to start writing stuff down for liasis.
Course, it's not clicking.
Oh my God.
There we go. Hey, Nick, how you doing? Welcome to the show.
Good.
What's going on?
Well, same old stuff. Cleaning up after snakes, cleaning up after messy kids, usual stuff.
There you go.
I swear my whole life is just picking up crap. It's like whether it's snake crap or rat crap or my kids' crap, it's always something, man. Just wait. You'll have some of your own, and you'll see what I'm talking about.
Oh, God, no. Bite your tongue.
Yeah, I thought I was going to dodge that bullet myself for years and years, and here I am, 40-year-old man, a couple of young kids. Only now I'm, like, too old and just beaten down. I don't have the energy to keep up with them anymore. It's the reason why you're supposed to have kids when you're young. You got the energy. Man.
So they invented Nerf guns. You just shoot it at them. Hey!
There you go. Oh, man. So it sounds like you guys are having a good season so far.
Yeah.
Nothing yet, but mucking around. And then, of course, you know, Mr. Morph over there is getting like, I have everything.
Quietly building an army for a couple of years now.
It's insane, I know.
Yeah,
he
texts
me, he's like, I got the package from Nick. I'm like, what's in it? Oh, I don't even want to ask these questions.
Yeah, I got a few more bits and pieces to send him here pretty soon. So.
Yeah.
Lots of good stuff.
Yeah, cool. So, Nick, we wanted to talk tonight about liasis and, you know, often overlooked group of pythons.
Which I love.
Yep. And I thought maybe you would be the perfect guy to do that. So, I don't know. Why don't you just start us at the beginning and break it down?
I don't know. I mean, they are often overlooked. I don't. Other than being largely patternless, is the only thing I can figure as to why they're not more popular. Because they really are a great group of snakes. There's a bit of diversity there. It seems to me that if you like Indo-Australian pythons, you should like these because they're definitely in that in there and with a lot of that stuff. They're all super easy to keep. Really, none of them are particularly difficult to breed or anything. So they're generally pretty cooperative, really hardy snakes. The bad attitude is much ado about nothing. For the vast majority of them, they're pretty mellow. And even the worst ones aren't too terrible bad.
Yeah.
So they're certainly no worse than carpets on average and stuff. So, but no, they're great. What do you want to know?
Okay. Well, maybe you could
fire away.
Get out.
Well, what are you working with currently right now, Nick?
Currently here, I loaned out my Savu pythons because eventually when you get a collection the size of mine, you do have to deal with the laws of physics, and that dictates that there's only so many square feet inside of a building, and beyond that you just can't. I mean, it becomes impossible. So I did send those out on loan. I do own Savu pythons and have worked with them. Though, oddly, that's not particularly a difficult snake to breed, but I've been cursed. Just, bad luck and, or for whatever reason, or maybe I'm just doing it wrong, or I don't know. But, I've had all of my friends have bred them. all my friends that work with them have bred them. I think, I should have accidentally done it by now, but that seems to be... I bred a lot more difficult things, but that one just seems to stump me. I don't know. I'll get it eventually. Aside from the Savus, I work with Australian olive pythons, obviously, Maclots pythons, and Fuscus. Maclots, Fuscus, and Maclots is kind of a complex, and they bounce them back and forth taxonomically, and no one can seem to agree what's what. It really should be, in my estimation, it should be three species, not two. You've got two different – the thing with Fuscus is they all look the same on the outside pretty much. The ones in Queensland are a little smaller and a little meaner and a little mellower and a little darker. But from 10 feet away, they all look the same. But the ones in Northern Territory and, northern parts of West Australia, they tend to be a little bit larger, a little bit nastier. Maybe a little bit browner as opposed to some of the Queensland and New Guinea ones will be almost black. And genetically, they're vastly different snakes. They look pretty much the same on the outside, but genetically, this is how confusing it is. Take a second to wrap your brain around it, but you basically have two forms of Fuscus. You've got the Queensland and New Guinea Fuscus, which look the same. Mm-hmm. Genetically, they are the same because, 6,000 years ago, you could walk from Cape York to New Guinea and not get your feet wet. So there's a reason why they're the same snakes. Same exact reason why Marut chondros and Cape York chondros are pretty much the same snake. It just hasn't been a long enough separation there to really develop any sort of separate identity genetically. But the Queensland New Guinea Fuscus are the same, but the Northern Territory, what's called Northern Territory Fuscus, but all the rest of the Fuscus are different genetically. The Queensland or the Northern Territory Fuscus are actually genetically more closely related to a Maclots python, which they look nothing like, than they are to a Queensland Fuscus, which they look exactly like. The two snakes that are genetically they look the same on the outside, but should be separate species. And the and one of them is closer to a Maclot python than it is to the other one, and they don't look anything like a Maclot python. It's a little bit confusing. I think the only way it makes any sense is to partition it, and you have, as far as zoological nomenclature, the rule of priority would then state that the Queensland New Guinea ones would remain Fuscus, and you'd have to come up with a new name for the Northern Territory ones, because the type locality is in Queensland for Fuscus. So, because they're clearly not the same as this is where you read all these papers and all this the academic literature, and a lot of it's really brilliant, really great research, really really good stuff. And then there'll be something in there that's like, these people have never kept a snake in a box before. You find this oftentimes, and I've pored over quite a number of academic papers and stuff, because that's kind of the source material for everything and stuff, the raw data, and that's all great. But you do, I do think that there is something that can be gleaned from herpetoculturists, because there are things that the academics that are, you know, counting scales and they're, you know, and they're testing DNA and these kinds of things that they seem to miss on that are really obvious if you've ever worked with these snakes. I mean, if you read the paper talking about that, well, you know, there's no difference between a Macklot and a Fuscus from Northern Territory. It's like, have you ever even seen these two things? I mean, they don't look this way. They're different sizes, live in different places, they're different colors with different patterns, their skull structure is different. I mean, it's the different snake. I mean, it's just, they're just different snakes. It's so I don't understand why they can't seem to figure that one out. You have the same kind of a thing with a lot of the same researchers, actually, with green tree pythons, where, you know, talk about, oh, we were really surprised that the northern ones and the southern ones were so different genetically. It's like, because you can't tell them apart on the outside. I'm like, really? Have you ever looked at these? I mean, it's like, you can totally tell. I bet you that most experienced chondro keepers could tell a Biot chondro from an Aru chondro by feel. If you blindfold them, they can probably feel the difference, and the head structure is totally different. The tail, they're just different. They're not even shaped the same, let alone color and everything. And it's just, so how academics tend to miss the obvious things like that, perhaps it's getting lost in some of the minutiae or something. But some of these, mm-hmm. you know, even consistent visual indicators and morphological clues, they seem to miss and stuff. So,
wow.
But that's one of the most confusing things about the Lyasis genus, I guess, is just the what's going on between the Fuscus and Eastern and Western. Eastern Western Fuscus and the Macklotti kind of clade and sorting all that out and stuff. I've noticed a trend in kind of academic, I'm sure I'm not the only person to notice this, but in the last 10 or 15 years, that a lot of papers will come out and they will like come up with some pretty solid data and then not quite go all the way with it. You know, like if you've got excellent data that, you know, as there is, that Baroni, the subspecies of olipython, the western subspecies, should be a full species, why not name it, elevate it to a full species? It's like they do the present all the data, here's this open and shut, airtight case, it's rock solid, and then don't do it. I don't know if it's hedging because you don't want to, in case somebody else figures out later that maybe it was, you know, incorrect, or then you're never really pinned down as being wrong because you never really put your neck out in the first place. But there's just tons and tons of instances of this. And this is where, you know, there's a rather well-known person in Australia who has a habit of going around and naming things and stuff based on these sorts of situations. Someone will stop short of naming a new species even though they did all the work and then they don't name it. So then, you know, it gets named by somebody else. And I just don't understand that. In some of these cases where it's very, very obvious. And, you know,
wow.
If you read these papers, I mean, it's considerable. These are not light reading. It's, pretty weighty stuff. And to that end, if anybody is, you know, really interested in the really nuts and bolts of this, there's a couple of great papers. The best one specifically on the Lyasis genus was written by Leslie Rawlings, David Barker, and Stephen Donnellan. And Rawlings and Donnellan in particular are kind of the forefront of genetic testing for pythons and, you know, sorting out molecular characters in user phylogeny and stuff. So the paper is Phylogenetic Relationships of the Australopapuan Lyasis Pythons, using mitochondrial, based on mitochondrial DNA. Came out in 2004. It's fantastic. And any paper these guys write, if there's any paper that deals with genetics and pythons, you'll usually see Donnellan's name almost always, and usually Rawlings as well and stuff. They're really the guys leading the charge with that stuff. Previously, everything we've thought we knew and everything, a lot of stuff was not right, turns out. You know, when you're making best guesses based on, you know, body morphology and stuff, that's not quite as exact. It does seem that there's oftentimes a bit of non-concordance between phenotype and genotype. I mean, it might look a certain way, but that doesn't mean you're necessarily related. It could just be convergent.
Right.
They're figuring out now that there's a lot more convergence of morphological characters and that aren't really indicative of any deeper underlying genetic relationships. So, but that paper, it's great. You can find it online, actually. You can even find a free copy of it online if you look. Another great tool for anybody looking to learn more about this stuff at that kind of level, if you just get on Google and you go through, there's different ways you can search on Google. You can look up Google Scholar. and it just pulls up scholarly articles and journal publications and stuff like that. And you can find a surprising amount of stuff for free that's just out there for everybody. And it's some of that stuff's a little hard to – you got to get used to reading it because, the, you know, the nomenclature they'll use and stuff's a little more technical and stuff. But you can you can usually get the gist of it. You might have to pay a little more attention or go over it a couple times, but there's really interesting stuff. And I've noticed the papers published in the last 10 years have gotten increasingly more comprehensive. It's not just, you know, usually about, you know, a genetic relationship between this or that. They'll usually go into kind of historical scenarios and kind of an attempt to explain how things arrived at this point and stuff. So you get kind of a big picture view and stuff. And that's certainly the case with all the Rawlings and Donilon papers. Another paper that's really good that the same guys, Rawlings, Donilon, and a few others put out in 2008, it's Python Phylogenetics, Inference for Morphology in Mitochondrial DNA. It's a bit of a read, but it puts all of the Australian and New Guinea python, that whole radiation of pythons, it kind of puts them all in place genetically, including the divergence times, what's related to what, how long these lineages, using a molecular clock, how long, you know, the estimated time these lineages diverge from each other, so you get a sense of what's related to what and how much and how long ago they shared a common ancestor. So for really kind of seeing the big picture, it's really a great paper. And there's a bunch of lysis stuff in there as well. So with the lysis, what you find is that all the evidence suggests and stuff is that pythons were for the longest time believed to have originated in New Guinea or in Australia and then radiated north through New Guinea and outward, and it appears now it's just the opposite, that they began in Asia or Africa and then migrated down into Australia, as did varanids and stuff. So the two of the most iconic, and elapids, so all the iconic Australian reptiles, none of them are actually originated there. They all came from elsewhere and then colonized Australia.
Huh.
And what you see is that, you know, you had probably a very small initial, you know, group of colonizers and everything, but once you get from, you know, hopping in islands and stuff to a large continental mass with a bunch of different ecosystems and habitat types and stuff, you see a rapid rate of diversification. So about 35 million years ago, basically once pythons get to Australia, there's this explosion of diversification and stuff. And you see all these different lineages beginning to separate out. And that kind of activity peaked about 25 million years ago. But by about 27 million years ago, all the different genera of pythons in Australia and New Guinea that we're familiar with were all already more or less distinct groups on their own trajectories by about 27 million years ago.
Okay.
Stuff, including, the split between Lysis and Morelli is a little bit older, right at about 35 million years ago. They were kind of on separate branches of that, relatively close to the roots. So, and the closest living relative of the Lysis genus is the Aspidites genus.
Really?
Which are not, I mean, yeah, really? They're not... Aspidites is not a primitive. I mean, that was the other thing that they thought. Well, they don't have any heat pits. They must be some primitive, you know, throwback ancestral type of thing. And they're really not. They're just, you know, they had heat pits and lost them because if you're digging around in the sand a lot, having heat pit, and you eat reptiles anyway, the heat pits aren't as important. And if they're clogged with sand all the time, that probably sucks. So we don't need those. They go away. Seriously. I mean, they've now anatomically figured out that, you know, blackheads do have a heat pit on their rostral scale. It's just kind of scaled over and stuff. But if you're not eating warm-blooded prey and you're living around in an early sandy habitat that's getting all jammed up from the sand, probably sucks. So don't want that and stuff. Hmm. So, yeah.
So I got a question for you, Nick. Just on this is not really to do with Lyasis, but just pythons in general. Do you think that they're still evolving? I mean, it's constantly evolving.
Everything is.
Right? Yeah.
Absolutely. Nothing ever... The natural world, I mean, whether you're talking about species or plate tectonics or climate, no matter what you're talking about, you know, any of these systems on the Earth, you know, geology, nothing is ever, the only constant is that it's changing. Nothing is ever standing still. All these processes, be it biological processes like evolution or, you know, like I said, plate tectonics or, you know, all this other kind of major climate shift, all this other stuff, it's all still ongoing. It just seems like it's standing still because we are just so kind of insignificant in the kind of scale of time that we're talking about.
Yeah.
We tend to think of everything as being the way it is when we are here, and we're just here for a snapshot. This is how it is today. It was not how it was yesterday, and it's not how it will be tomorrow. Everything is always changing. in terms of the evolution of species, it's all climate is the prime mover and shaker, really. It's, you know, everything. You know, you take animals like carpets that are very dependent on trees. It's like, well, where are you going to, you know, where there's trees, there's carpets. Where there's no trees, there's not. So as the climate fluctuates, you know, that affects your vegetation. Your rainfall affects your vegetation. That affects where your trees are. Wherever the tree line is, that's where the carpets are. No trees, no carpets. So you see this kind of, if you look at, you know, all these papers that deal with, you know, the phylogenetics and stuff and when things split off and all that. And then if you look at, you know, a whole other science of, you know, there's a whole lot of people who study past climate, paleoclimate, and all that kind of stuff, and geology. If you overlay the geology, the paleoclimate, and the, you know, the phylogeny stuff, you will find a really strong kind of concordance between all of those things. You'll see that things tend to divert when the weather changes and the, you know, the vegetation changes. You'll see, you know, species will split or come together accordingly and stuff. That's we tend to think of the range of a species as being kind of a static. You know, oh, it's this shaped like this. It's like really picture more of like an amoeba, just this kind of undulating shape that it never stops moving. It's like ranges of species will expand, they will contract. They're never standing still. It only feels like that because we can't look at things in the kind of the time scale that it's operating at and stuff. So no, they're absolutely still changing. As are we're still changing. People are still changing. Mm-hmm. You know, a great example of that is, yeah, mm-hmm. look up the average height of Japanese people in Japan prior to World War II and today. They're taller today than they were before World War II. The reason now it's like you got more access to beef because you raise more cattle in northern Japan and stuff, and you're eating more protein, thus you grow taller. I mean, it's like a whole, and that's just in a generation. People are taller in that one spot. So nothing ever stands still. It's always changing.
That's awesome. That stuff is.
Well, you look at. I mean, another example. I mean, I'm getting as usual. Like always, I wander off on a tangent. But if you look at a great example of this, and then I'll get off that subject, is Tanimbar pythons. You look at Tanimbar pythons, you have four color phases. You know, you've got exanthic, you've got patternless, you got patternless, exanthic, and xanthic, and you know, and all the combinations therein. So. I was one of the first, I think BPI bred them 1 year, the first time ever. I bred them the following year for the second ever breeding, and then a friend of mine, Ryan Young, bred them a couple of years later. But he bred an offspring that I produced with one that BPI had produced. But since we knew what all the parent animals were, and so if we were able to work out that the patternless trait and the exanthic trait were both recessive. The tricky part is that for some reason, the most common phenotype in the wild on Tanimbar is the exanthic patternless. So... Huh. It's a double mutant. And the rarest form on Tanimbar is the patterned gold, which is the absence. So what you have is a situation where it's the same thing as a snowball or something, it'd be like statistically a 1 in 16 double recessive mutant. Yet that is, imagine if like a snow boa was the most common boa you encountered in the Amazon and the rarest boa you found would be the normal. That's what you have on Tanimbar. The least common by a wide margin, too. It's by a wide margin. Most of them are exanthic patternless, and very few of them are patterned gold ones, which is the absence of these morphs. And what is that? That's this animal is evolving. It's changing. And it's only a mutation until there's no more normals left. At some point when everybody's an exanthic, that just becomes the new normal. It's not a mute. It's not a morph then. That's just the new kind of default setting with that stuff. I personally suspect in the case of Tanimbar, it's due to deforestation. If you're an arboreal species, which they most certainly are, extremely arboreal, being gold in pattern and more or less looking like tree bark is probably a pretty good way to go. Unfortunately, the Tanimbar archipelago is like 98% deforested. There's cut down all trees. So if you're, it doesn't do you any good to be patterned like tree bark if there's no trees to live in. Being patterned with gray, probably being patterned like a rock, maybe that's working better now. I mean, these things are changing, and there's one that's changing probably in rather rapidly and stuff. And I'm sure that somehow cutting down the overwhelming majority of the forest probably had something to do with that. And there's other examples of that have been noticed over the last century of animals, these color mutations and stuff rising to dominance in a in a population in response to even human activity.
Right. Well, as far as water pythons, I know I was talking to you the other day, and you were talking to me about their scales, and I found what you were telling me pretty interesting. Could you hit on that? Because it's a species that spends a lot of time in water.
Oh, well, this touches on another thing we're talking about, too. We're talking about, mentioned earlier, evolutionary convergence. Evolutionary convergence is just the, unrelated animals or distantly related animals, essentially, in response to similar situations, will evolve similar solutions to similar problems. That's why you get things like emerald tree boas, and chondros. And it's like, gee, they're both white snakes or green snakes with white markings that sit on a branch exactly the same way on opposite sides of the planet, not that related, but you both will drink off their coils, come up with the same solution to the same problem. The same is true with the scales. If you were to look at the scales of really iridescent snakes, like water pythons are one of the world's most iridescent snakes, also white lips, ring pythons, rainbow boas, sunbeam snakes, you will find little tiny ridges that you can't really see them unless you're under magnification. There's little tiny ridges, like fingerprint ridges, on the scale. And what that is an adaptation to deflect water. Water will basically bead off of their scales to keep their skin drier. And you only find that in animals, in snakes that live in damp conditions all the time. Water pythons, with their predilection for being in water, obviously is an obvious one. In the other cases, like sunbeam snakes are very fossorial, wet leaf litter. Rainbow boas, same thing. The other species that are like that will typically live in like damp leaf litter conditions. And if you didn't have something like that, you'd be prone to getting skin blisters and skin condition issues from being too damp. So, opposite sides of the planet, different families even of snakes, and they come up with the same exact solution to the same problem. And that's why water pythons are so iridescent.
Right.
I think if most people could handle them and see them, they'd really like them. They really are neat.
There's
nothing like them. They're awesome. And it's unfortunate that they are just so rare in the hobby and stuff. It's not as if we're getting new bloodlines of Fuscus anytime soon and stuff. So what we've got for a captive gene pool is what we've got. And, if we mismanage that or nobody keeps it going, we could lose that species in the hobby altogether. And we're not far from that now, really. There's, I don't know how many Fuscus are produced in a year. I'd be shocked if it's more than 20.
Jesus.
I think last year there was fewer than 10 that I'm aware of, unless I find it hard to believe there's somebody cranking out lots of them I've never heard of and stuff, because I've been looking, and there isn't much out there and stuff. And I think I would like it if people would pay a little more attention to these things in their regard. That's maybe not the right terminology. That sounds a little like a condemnation, but at least give it a thought. Carpet morphs are cool and ball morphs. That's all cool. I understand why people have that stuff. Hell, I've got all that stuff. But there are other things that, maybe think about having a brown snake, or a batterless snake, because they're neat. I mean, they really are, and it would be a shame if, as a hobby, we didn't put enough value on those things and they were lost. And if you look at the number of ringed pythons that are produced, or Fuscus, those two are, in particular, but the Fuscus more than anything, I mean, we could lose those if people don't breed them. We've already lost dunnage pythons, find Lysis dunni, good luck with that. I mean, there are a few animals in the United States, but that's about it, and they're very old, and we had them here. They actually got bred here, and now we effectively have lost a species purely because nobody bothered. Not for any other reason, not because they won't breed, but because nobody could be bothered to do it and stuff, and that's just a shame. So.
Wow.
I mentioned dunni, the species we've effectively lost. I'm not trying to track some down in Europe, because the same thing there, but there was more produced in Europe, so the odds of finding some are better. Not a lot better, but, I'll eventually track them down. But used to be a subspecies of Maclot's python, only occurs on Wittar Island, which apparently is a difficult place to get to. They're a small form and everything. Genetically, turns out, should be a full species. They were actually believed extinct at one point about 100 years ago. Then they were rediscovered. Then they actually imported them, like, once. And then here we are right back to don't have them, can't get any more. And they're, it's a whole species of python most people don't even know exists.
Yeah. Wow. And what do they look like, Nick?
They kind of look like a cross between a Maclot and a Savu. None of these things are flashy snakes. I mean, they're a little bigger than a Savu. They're not as big as a Maclot. Maclot pythons are wildly variable in size. Like, I've seen them bred at 4 feet, which is, kind of smallish carpet size, and I've also seen 10-footers, so, I mean, that laid 50 eggs. So apparently the adult size range is an enormous range. I mean, I tend to try to keep things small. I don't want to make 50 of anything, of any one thing, but but I've seen a few really, you know, pretty good-sized maclots and stuff. And even maclots by themselves are really three different snakes. I mean, they're they occur in three different islands and stuff, and each of those islands is Roti, Samau, and Timor, and they're all morphologically distinct. Not necessarily at the, you know, separate species level, but they are, I mean, they are different looking and stuff. So there's a lot to collect if anybody wants to get into lysis. Again, though, it's like you have a hard time finding a Samau maclot python or a Roti maclot python. 99, the few you find are almost always from Timor. And stuff. The other two islands were only ever imported, I believe, once. But they do exist, which is very difficult. Very difficult to find. Trying to track this stuff down, I feel like you know, you get these guys in Florida that spend their whole life searching for sunken treasure ships or something. Sunken Spanish galleons. I feel like I'm trying to find some obscure island form of maclot nobody cares about, but in the hobby. But you know, I don't know. It's, I think there's a certain thrill from the looking and stuff, and the trying to track it down, and then you finally find something. So,
right? Yeah, we were talking about. Just on a side note, I'm just watching the Facebook page, and I see Paul Harris posted up his
Silver Savus are up there.
Wow!
He posted up what?
Picture of his Silver Savus.
Oh yeah.
Seeing them? Yeah. Wow. They're awesome.
Some sort of anathristic thing.
Yeah.
The Savus, I mean, go through a color change. They actually are the coolest looking baby. Have you ever seen a baby like right out of the egg? They're orange. They're like a orange and pink.
Yeah.
With white eyes, they're crazy looking. I mean, they just gain increasing amounts of... I don't think the red really ever goes away. It just gets covered over with dark scales, and sometimes in old age they'll be nearly solid black with white eyes. But you do see some that'll... so they have, like, a lot of selective breeding potential. I've had adults that were full-blown adults that were only maybe 20% black. They had, you know, they were mostly still orange and stuff. So it seems that they're... they vary, and there'd be a strong, you know, case that could be made for selective breeding to not have them go all black and stuff. But that takes, you know, people to keep them and value them and stuff. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, that's been the biggest problem for the lysis and stuff. You hear a lot of, oh, they're cool. Well, did you have any? Well, no. Like, and you're talking to people like, they'll have hundreds of snakes or 100 snakes. Like, you can't squeeze one pair of these things in there somewhere. You know,
yeah.
There really are... you know, the like my Queensland Fuscus, I love them. They're totally docile. They're really docile, and they're small. My male is maybe the diameter of my index finger and, you know, 2.5 feet long.
Jesus.
Yeah, and he gets in there and gets it done, too.
Mine just had a different kind then. Mine are bigger.
The problem with water pythons is, A, there are hardly any of them to be had, and you don't know where any of them are from. Finding them that you can attribute to one of the three populations is the really difficult part. It took me... I don't know, 4 years to get any water pythons from the time I started looking for water pythons to the time I had some. And in that time, I ran across 3 or 4 specimens, but nobody could tell me anything. Wildcock, captive bred, New Guinea, let alone Queenslander in Northern Territory. It was just impossible. It took a long time to find some that I could attribute to. And I was, like, okay with any of the populations. I wasn't even looking for a particular one. I was like, I just want to know what it is. I don't care which. I just want to know, you know, and get a group going from one of these places. And even that proved quite difficult.
Right.
There have been all three populations have been in the United States. I believe all the Northern Territory ones appear to have died out or have been lost into the ether of, you know, time, and no one seems to know what happened to them. I mean, it's always possible there's somebody sitting on some somewhere. They live a long time, potentially. I do have Northern Territory ones I got from Europe and stuff. But, I mean, I had to pay an exorbitant amount and took me quite some time to get them. And I've got the little Queensland ones, which are, at least in my collection, seem to be want to be smaller and stuff. Mm. And the New Guinea ones, you could still get wild-caught ones if anybody cared to import them. You know, it's, like it's not that they can't get them. It's that they don't bother because they don't believe there's any market for them. And the range in New Guinea, the known range in New Guinea, is really small. It's really just like in the south-central part, which is exactly where you find, you know, the you know, all the Australian species. You've got these little patch of Australia that's in southern New Guinea where you get blue tongues and frilled lizards and carpet pythons and water pythons and spotted pythons and stuff. So it's there's a seasonal wetland area there that's just like Kakadu, essentially, and it's right around there. So really the only place that I'm sure there might be other scattered populations, but that's the known population of them in New Guinea.
Wow.
Now, with keeping the water pythons, obviously water pythons, they spend a lot of time in water, but is there any special requirements that they need to be kept in captivity?
No, I don't. I mean, I've got them with a 4-inch water bowl, and they seem to do just fine. It's they don't need to have a I know if I were to give them a large water dish to soak in, they'd probably sit in it, and they'd make it do what snakes tend to do, and you'd let them soak in a water bowl and stuff. But in a, you know, an 82 degree building, a filthy tub of water, it just would require effectively daily, you know, sanitation.
right.
You get some crud growing in there real fast. Nothing like imagine that. Oh, it's like an 82 degree bowl of water with a dirty snake sitting and crapping in it or something. That's just gonna. No, I just give them the same small disposable water bowl set up. I do keep those on cypress mulch, which I can keep a little bit damp, but. You know, I live in a desert, and even still, I don't really have any problem with sheds or anything. They're very durable. When you say, hear the name water python, one thinks, oh, well, they got a, you got, it's like an anaconda or something, and that's not it at all. You could keep them on paper. I have kept, I do, actually, I do keep my male on paper. I keep my female in a much larger enclosure, and he spends a lot of time in the cage with her and stuff, but on the cypress, but they're very, very undemanding. In that regard,
is there a difference in the markings on the belly? I heard that. I think I've heard that before. That you could tell where they come from by.
You know, I don't know if I would put any. I mean, you see aberrantly patterned individuals of everything, and it's very difficult to say. In a general kind of rule of thumb for everything in life, it's never good to speak in absolutes. You know, it's like there's always, give yourself a little wiggle room. Nothing is, very few things are, other than math, outside of mathematics, nothing, there are no absolutes really. The queen's little ones I have, the belt, and old age. Now my snakes are getting, you know, up there in years and stuff, and I've noticed that the orange belly was more orange, and as in old age has gotten a little bit of dirt and a little smudginess to it and stuff, whereas the Northern Territory animals, it was more of a gold color on the belly and a little bit cleaner in that regard. As last year when we were, me and Justin and some others were in Australia, and we got fortunate enough to do some field herping. One of the places we went to was Fog Dam in Northern Territory, which is the highest concentration of vertebrate predators anywhere in the world is Fog Dam, Northern Territory, and it's water pythons. It's an artificial dam. It's an earthen dam. It's just made out of dirt with a road across top of it, and it just in a big marshy area full of crocs on one side and more water pythons than you could even comprehend. It's
wow.
Like there's something about this area where it's just like hyper productive for rats. So there's just in this absurd amount of rats. Well, where there's a lot of rats, there's going to be a lot of snakes to eat those rats. And it's we went there on a moonless night. We were there 1 hour, caught 6 water pythons in 1 hour. Pretty much every single pass across the top of the dam caught a different snake. It was just insane. And if you've ever road cruised for snakes, that's you don't find something every 5 or 10 minutes. That was in addition to finding multiple other snakes, turtles, frogs, geckos, I mean other stuff too, but just the water pythons, about one every pass. One of the ones, the first one we found was a gravid adult female, or appeared to be gravid. Found an adult, a small adult male with one eye. And not an eye, not missing an eye because he got bit or lost an eye in a fight or something like that, but was born eyeless on one side, just smooth, no scaled over. The eye was just never there. But that shows you how productive of an environment is. Born with one eye gone, no problem. I mean, and
whoa.
They looked good. They look all of them. None of them looked skinny. I mean, you catch, you know, you find wild snakes road cruising. Most of the time, they look like death warmed over. You know, they're pretty beat up. These guys look great. Like, this is just the place to be if you're a water python. It's
wow.
Also, there's been a large amount of stuff published on water pythons because it's such a, because that area is accessible and there's so many of them there. It's a great place to do research and stuff. And Dr. Richard Schein and his colleagues have done just mountains of research on that population of water pythons and stuff because it's, I mean, it's almost like the only place you can go where you're guaranteed to find a python.
Wow.
I mean, I couldn't imagine, I mean, you know, unless it's like there's a full moon or something, which tends to kind of thwart your efforts a little bit. But as long as there's not any, you know, as long as it's dark pretty much, you're going to, it's just crazy. They haul out onto the bank, get up onto the road, they're sitting on the edge of the road. Just, you know, there's just, it's, it was awesome.
Wasn't there a paper done with water pythons and basically they were incubating their eggs and then at some point they leave the eggs they don't stay out the maternal incubation?
Really?
Did you know anything about that, Nick?
Not that they would habitually leave the eggs. I mean, maternally incubating females leaving their eggs is not an unheard of thing in any species and stuff. I tend to think they wouldn't leave their eggs unless there was a compelling reason to do so, i.e. needed to warm up or, you know, or what have you. But typically snakes or pythons are really good at picking a good nest site to lay their eggs. They kind of check that out and figure out a good place to lay it in advance so they don't have too many problems. I've done, in the last 3 years, I've done quite a bit of maternal incubation experiments and stuff, and you know, with inserting data logging probes into the clutches and stuff, and I have never had one leave the eggs yet. I've had them like halfway leave the eggs to bask and then come back to them and stuff. But even that, I had to put them, to get them to do that, I had to intentionally put them in a situation where it wouldn't be warm enough to see what, just because I wanted to see what they would do.
Mm-hmm.
And even
right.
Under the most extreme circumstances, they would, you know, they'd come right back and stuff. But under normal conditions, they just pretty much they don't wander too far, or move, or seemingly move at all and stuff. So,
okay.
If wild ones are, I mean, that would be indicative of, you know, something else going on. Usually, they're gonna pick a good place.
Okay.
There's been so much stuff. It's a mountain of stuff to get through on the water pythons and stuff at Fog Dam from Shine and stuff.
Google Doc. What did you say it was? Google Scholar.
Google, there's a, you know,
Google,
you can search there. That gives you, there's other options you can search for, kind of search parameters, and one of them is called Google Scholar.
Right.
And it just searches for that kind of stuff, you know, various mm-hmm. journals, of which there's millions of them and stuff. And oftentimes you can find the PDF online for nothing. A lot of times you can find them, and there's outfits that'll, you know, want to sell you a copy. But a lot of times you can download a PDF for nothing and stuff. And it's not the kind of reading I realize a lot of herpers do, but it's certainly not anything that you can't get your brain around and stuff. And a lot mm-hmm. of a lot of interesting observations and stuff in there, especially if you're kind of on the nerdy side of things like me. A lot of, well, I mean, I like keeping snakes and pretty snakes in boxes too, but there's other reasons why these animals are interesting other than the paint job.
Yep.
You know, there's a whole lot to be interested in there, and it's I think it's why one of the greatest hobbies ever is herpetoculture, because it's, it, you know, it stimulates your mind too. It's, there's a bit of an intellectual component to it and stuff. It's not just purely creating living art, as I've heard it expressed,
right.
And stuff. There's, I guess you can, if that's what you're into, and we all probably are on some level. But there's other levels to herpetoculture that, you know, may not be for everybody, but it's interesting. People should take a look at some of that stuff. And there's a lot of it over the years.
Cool. Now let's, how about some olive pythons? Basically, yeah. Albinos are in the States, right? I believe.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And, you know, do you think that they'll start to become more popular with albinos being out there?
Well, I mean, I think they're awesome the way they are. It kind of almost like, I'm sure that the availability of albinos, and they make a pretty good albino, will increase awareness, and thus more people will keep them. Personally, it's a little bit almost disappointing to me. It's like that no one cares until there's an albino. I mean, these things are awesome just the way they were. And if you ask anybody that has ever had an olive, they'll all tell you that too. It's one of those, like, it's like inland carpets or some of this other stuff that maybe isn't the flashiest thing, but for some reason, it's just awesome, and it's hard to put a finger on why. Olive pythons are like that, and, you know, ask anybody that's worked with them, they'll all tell you that, usually. They're a little different than the other lysis. They're a little bit drier adapted. I mean, it's, you know, it's a monsoon kind of woodland area, I mean, throughout much of their range and stuff, but they don't need high humidity. They don't really need much of anything. They're real generalists, eat just about anything and stuff. They have kind of a, I don't know, they're just something different. They almost seem like they have a personality to them that they seem smarter than other pythons, if that makes sense. You just like, it's almost like you just see the wheels turning when you look at it, like, this snake's going to find a way out of this if it's not secure. It's like they just seem like they've got more. I don't know, it's very unscientific of me to, it just seems like you just get a sense of them that they've got more going on upstairs than some of the other stuff.
Yes.
They have a real personality, have a scary feeding response. They are, they're real true generalists. You know, most things like carpet pythons, which I know a lot of your listeners and you guys really work with a lot of, eat a lot of, primarily are mammal eaters. All the pythons will eat anything. They have been known to eat children's pythons, for example. They've been known to eat rough scale pythons. Wallabies, anything that they can pretty much overpower. They're true generalists. Like most other pythons, you know, specialize a bit and stuff. It's interesting when you find multiple species of python in the same area, you usually see what's called niche partitioning, where it's like everybody has their own, like, their own habitat type and their own thing that they eat, so they don't actually compete as directly as one would think.
Right.
And stuff. Mm-hmm. The almost only real exception to that seems like in Northern Territory you have olive pythons and blackheads in the exact same places. And they're both, you know, 8, 9, 10 foot long, you know, terrestrial pythons and stuff. Difference being the blackheads eat 85% of their diet in the wild as other reptiles. And olive pythons will certainly eat, you know, as many reptiles as they can consume, but they will also eat every bird, every mammal, everything. They don't specialize and stuff. When we were there on that same trip, we were fortunate enough to catch a blackhead and an olive python on the same road, like 45 minutes apart. 45 minutes later, they're both about 7 foot long, and they were, you know, on the same exact stretch of road. And that's, when I say 45 minutes, it sounds like you'd go a long ways, but if this, you know, you're driving at 5 miles an hour, that's really not even that far, you know, and stuff. But it just shows you kind of that kind of hyper abundance in that habitat, that area is kind of a, I mean, you've got just scads of python species in that same area. You also found children's pythons on that road. There's, you know, carpet pythons. There's this, you know, water pythons in that area. You've got 5 different python species in the same, in a very tight geographic area and stuff. But it shows the productivity of the of that kind of an ecosystem that it can support all of that.
Jeez.
Well, you also got, you know, elapids and just, I mean, millions of other snakes and stuff, too. It's not just pythons. I mean, there are lots and lots of stuff, but...
Is there anything special about... Are these guys difficult to breed in captivity, or...?
Olive pythons?
Yes.
I would say of the group, of the Lysis group, and I will readily admit I have not, my own personal failings with Savuensis notwithstanding... I've not worked with Dunn's pythons because I can't get any.
Right.
I'm told they're very easy to breed. I've had friends that have bred them when they were more readily available, but I can't get those. Of the others, olives are the more difficult to breed. They don't require anything special or anything fancy or any extra bells and whistles, really, to breed them. You don't have to do anything weird. I found that the role of male combat is really important with olive pythons.
Really?
I tried to breed a single pair of olive pythons for 9 consecutive years without in that time I managed to record a whopping 1 copulation and 2 incidents of spurring in 9 years. Got a second male, had eggs every year. It's almost like, it's like in carpets, it's the same kind of thing. It's like, well, I didn't really care about breeding before, but I'm certainly not going to let that other guy do it, so okay. And then they just do it. It's except for it's not... Where it differs from combat and carpet pythons is they'll kill each other. Carpets, it's largely a ritualized kind of affair. It's kind of interesting to watch, and they wrestle and they do their thing, and you don't let it get too crazy and, you know, and stress the subordinate male out or whoever would be a loser. But in olive pythons, it's you have to stand right there, and it usually a combat session, you never, if you let it get to the point where they're combating, you've waited too long. It's like once one male crawls across the other male's back and the other male realizes there's another male on top of him and he arches his back real fast, pull him apart. Because you're, at that point, usually just a few seconds away from biting and constricting and killing of each other. They will absolutely kill each other. It is to the death. And I've had friends that have had olive pythons, males literally kill they don't. There's none of this wrestling, and then oh, I'll wrestle and I'll pin you down, but we won't bite each other. It's like, oh no, it's like they bite and constrict almost immediately, and
God.
Stuff. And it's but it's like the greatest motivator you couldn't believe. Like whoa, like it really makes a difference and stuff. So it's
all
just
right,
a different.
I need to get another boy.
It's more. It is like. It's similar to breeding to blackheads, not in the combat thing, but in the body condition is a big issue with a lot of pythons, and I know we probably talked on previous interviews and stuff before that people tend to overfeed their snakes, and the more expensive it is, the more they tend to overfeed it and stuff. You tend to favor your favorite snakes, which tend to be your most expensive snakes, and then by favoring them, you feed them too much food, and in some cases, you screw them up. And just like blackheads, if you... I'm sure I know you've had Derek on a few times, and I'm sure he mentioned that you know if you feed these guys a whole bunch of fatty rats, you'll screw them up, you'll kill them eventually.
Yeah.
I mean, they'll just crap out on you. You really got to be eating reptiles are a lot. It's a lot leaner, you know, food, and thus you know lower body fat content and stuff. And holopythons are the same way. They're supposed to be. Imagine a 10-foot California king snake. That's what an holopython should be. It shouldn't be like a berm, but they'll eat anything. And they'll eat every day. So you can't. They're just always turned on. And if you let them, an holopython won't die. So it's blackhead. You'll just shorten their lifespan tremendously. An holopython might live forever, but it'll never breed. They'll get big and fat, and they'll just never breed. So keep them smaller and leaner, and don't go crazy. They don't need to be that big to breed. They'll breed it. You know, most of my adults are, you know, not much bigger than, or any bigger than a, you know, coastal carpet, and the males aren't even that big. So they don't need to be
really?
Huge. Yeah, they don't need to be huge. I mean, my males are probably, both my males are probably 7 feet. And that's 7 feet and, you know, 15 years old. And I've got a female that's, you know, a bit bigger than that, but she's 17 years old. So she's 17 years old this year, and...
Right.
You know, so she might be 10 feet long, but it took her 17 years to get that big and stuff. So they don't need to be that big. Watch the male combat. Really important, but also kind of a calculated risk. You got to definitely be ready to pull them apart at a moment's notice and stuff. I guarantee if you put them together to combat and you go and you leave the room for a minute to answer the phone, you will lose a snake.
Jesus.
Most assuredly, it's brutal, but... and don't let them get too fat.
Okay.
Other than that, everything is like, you know, but not letting snakes get too fat is probably a good idea for everything.
For everything, right, yeah. Do that for all.
A lot of snakes in the wild, and not a single one of them was fat. Not a fat wild snake yet. Most of them look really rough, and or at best they look, you know, lean, but, you know, they never look fat and stuff,
Jeez.
So... That's one of the keys with that stuff, much like, you know, the Aspidites and stuff as well.
Oh, we've been doing that with our white lips and our scrubs. Is I guess the rule is, like, feed it every 2 weeks, or if it's, like, hitting its head against the glass going, dude, come on, I'm starving, then we can feed it.
I don't have a feeding schedule. I find that if you pay attention to your animals and stuff, you'll be able to... That'll tell you the most thing, the most, more than anything else, is everybody's, just like your metabolic rate and mine, there might be different. If you and I each ate exactly the same meals with exactly the same amount of calories every day, one of us would lose weight and one of us would gain weight. It's not the same for everybody. It's like you can't expect to be the same for every snake. I just try to feed just barely enough to keep good muscle tone and body mass once the snakes are adults and no extra. You know, especially with the males, you want them to be lean, a little smaller, a little leaner and stuff. You want lean, muscular, fit animals, but you don't want them fat. So I don't even think I own a male carpet python that's over 900 grams.
Wow.
I don't even think I have one that's over 900 grams. Because the bigger they get big, fat, and lazy. I mean, they don't – those little males, or they get in there and they get it done, they'll live forever. letting things get big and – really big and heavy, it's just not – I don't know. I'm less is more sometimes, I guess, on the food.
Makes sense.
Stuff. So I think a lot of it, I mean, there is it's herpetoculture, so we can't just ignore that greed is a factor. People want things to breed as quickly as possible and it'd be as many eggs as possible and get a return on investment as quickly as possible and stuff. And while that might work with some things for a while, it's typically going to, you know, the consequences of obesity and all this kind of, these kind of things are almost assuredly include shortened life expectancy and, you know, it's just, you know, you don't want to burn them up that fast. At least I don't and stuff. I'd like them to be around.
Right.
These things live a long time. You know, I had an olive python die at 17. One of my original male died. He was 17 years old, and I was pissed that he died at 17 years old for no clear reason at all, just up and rolled over, you know, as, you know, obviously that some animals do, they don't live forever. Sometimes animals do die, and we've certainly all lost animals on occasion, but it's pretty unusual. And even at 17 years, I'm like, this thing should have lived to be 40. I was mad that it only made it to 17.
Wow.
That stuff. That female that's the same age laid 20 eggs that year and stuff. So I think most people don't realize, they tend to think of, you know, you hear about animals dying and this and that and stuff. And, you know, all these things should live 35, 40 years or more. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if 50 years for most of these things and stuff. They're long lived with proper care. And part of that is, you know, don't hammer with the food so much, man. I mean, just roll it back a little bit. I mean, and there's strong research in all species, including humans, that the surest path to longevity is calorie restriction. You know, who lives to be 100 years old with people? Little tiny people who don't eat much. You know who lives the shortest life expectancy of people? NFL football players and professional wrestlers.
Yeah, that's true.
I'm not into professional wrestling and couldn't be less interested in anything than that. But if you look at, like, the number of those guys and how early they die, the bigger you are, everything you just wear out and your body's burned up and it's it. And little tiny people who hardly eat anything and weigh 85 pounds soaking wet live forever.
That's it. I'm on a diet tonight.
I say this and I'm like so totally out of shape too. Like, I'm like,
yeah,
I know all this information
over.
And yet I love bacon. So what am I going to do? I can extend my life number of years,
no,
or I can eat this bacon and bacon wins.
Bacon wins.
I know the data and I choose to ignore it because I like pork and stuff like that. So
that's
I just make bad decisions.
Yeah.
Any more life questions for me?
I guess, how do you keep your max? Like, do you keep them any different? Because my max
nothing different at all.
Like,
what?
My max tend to like the warmer. Like, you know, they're at 80, the higher 80s in their cage, as opposed to the carpet pythons, which are a little bit lower. The second the temp for the max dips below, let's say, 83, both of them are off food. I don't know what the hell's wrong with them. So it's kind of like
adults?
A canary in the coal mine. Hmm?
Are they adults?
Juveniles.
Weird. I'd be worried if a maclot skipped a meal. They seem like they're one of those things, like, this thing's either going to lay eggs or it's going to die if it's going to skip a meal, because they eat, man. They're machines.
I know that. Yeah, they're monsters. When if the temp is, like right now it's 86 and they both were flying out the bins at the food last night and they're both sitting fat and happy in their cage right now. But
their ambient air temperature is 86?
What? The rack's a little hot right now. But they're in a bin rack right now because I don't have any cage space.
Well, you know, some things, even, you know, if you can get a suitably large enough tub in a rack, some things will do better in a rack. Things that like, you know, a fair amount of humidity and stuff will do better in a rack. It's easier to keep humidity up in a rack and stuff. So things like the maclots and I've got racks with enormous tubs, though. I mean, not cramming them in a something small, but I also tend to keep my adults a little smaller than, you know, well, the case with the maclots. Like, there's not enough, you know, demand to make 50 of these things in a year. I just like working with them. But if I could get, you know, 10 maclot eggs, I'd be stoked. You know, that's fine.
Yeah.
My goal is not to populate the earth with these things. I mean, I just enjoy working with them, and it's, you know, I don't need to make an army of them and stuff. But
true.
I just keep them like everything else, not everything, but like most everything else and stuff. You know, my snake building keeps an ambient air temperature of about 80 to 82. You know, they can get a little warmer than that if they want to and stuff. And give them some options, and they generally do really well. They're probably one of the easier pythons to keep. The babies eat. The eggs are easy to hatch. The babies eat. They don't, they're not picky. They don't want to eat lizards or anything. They they're very cooperative in most regards. So
I think the cool thing about Max is I saw one in a pet shop one time, and I never gave it a second thought until I saw it in person, and then I picked it up. But then I had to give it to Owen because I needed incubator space.
Yep. And that is how the Liasis project started over here.
Yeah.
We got the Mac, and then, of course, we had to pair up the Mac, and then we got Waters, and then we got Olives, and I keep staring at Savu going, God damn it. So,
oh, you've got Olives there? Oh, you've got, sorry, you said you had Olives. Yeah, they're great.
Oh, they're,
now you get Savus are the easiest.
Saying,
they're easy, just as easy as the rest
figuring.
To keep, and they're small, small.
That's what I'm figuring. If I can handle, like, the Macs coming at my face, and then the Olives, if there's even, like, scenting of rat anywhere flying out of their cage, I can handle baby Savu. I mean, come on.
I've never been bit by a Maclot, or I've never been bit by a Liasis, I don't think. I don't think I've ever.
I have
what are you doing? What are you doing to those four snakes?
I don't know. Well, no.
That's it, Owen. I'm taking
well, first
them back.
Off, shut up. The male Mac is awesome. Is perfectly fine. Perfectly happy. The female Mac, I got off of the. I got her off Kingsnake. The Chase. Reptiles, like they have the Max, they breed Max something for like their dancing thing, whatever. I don't know. I got her.
Oh, and they keep saying that they're Savu Island Maclots.
Yeah, whatever.
But I'm just like, okay.
she's a monster. She's just a freaking. She's always been since I got her as a hatchling. She was just feisty, and now she just got size on her, and you know can back up. The water pythons are perfectly calm. And the Olives are only little terrors when there's food. I mean, the second there's food in the room, even if it's not for them, the Olives are up in the front of their cage waiting for the door to open. And if you open the door, you better have food right in front of them. Otherwise, they're all over the place. And what you said about them being smart and intelligent, they
curious.
Give you the same look.
Like they're,
yeah, they
get them on
the
your hand, and you're,
wet
even
wet
when they're babies, yeah. They'll cruise through your fingers, and they just seem curious about stuff more so than alert.
Yeah.
Yes. They're just neat.
Very exploring. So.
Yeah, I'm, for some reason, like, the Maclots probably have the least following of any of those species. The Fuscus, I mean, I've not produced armies of Fuscus and stuff, but they were easy to sell. And the Olives, I mean, I've bred them a number of times now, and they always, I think I've only ever actually had to run an ad for baby Olives one time, one day, and all the rest of them just sold through word of mouth. Oh, yeah, like olive pythons, they always seem to sell, so people do like them. I was a little bit, it kind of buoyed my spirits a little bit. I was at a show, and I had, you know, I've got a lot of different stuff, so, I mean, I got a show kind of on Saturday, and I'll have numbers of different species and all kinds of flashy this and that and morphs of this and that, and I had a pair of olive pythons, and, like, and I couldn't believe how people were, like, enamored, like, what are those? I'm like, they didn't know that they existed. But, like,
yeah.
My eyes went to the drab olive gray, green gray snake. I'm like, right on. Maybe there's hope yet.
Yeah.
Stuff. I mean, I love all the morphs. I like morphs of everything, and I like all that stuff, too. I mean, most of us do. But there's other cool things, too. It's like, I just like to see the hobby have a little bit more of a sense of balance. I mean, when you go to a show, it's like even – I breed a ton of – not a ton, but I breed a fair number of, you know, higher-end ball pythons of this and that. And even I don't want to look at them when I go to a show. Like, I've got a bunch of these things, and even I'm like, oh, more ball, skip it. I don't even want to look at it. It's like, even I'm sick of looking at them. I mean,
yeah.
And I like them and breed them. It's just, there's, you know, you want to see some variety and stuff, and there's a lot of cool things that there's not enough of. And stuff.
Right.
And all of any member of the Liasis genus, and I tell you, it's not going to be the ball python people that embrace it. It's got to be the carpet python people. That's a more...
Of course.
It's more, I think that a lot of people, I think if a lot of carpet people, of which, you know, obviously there's quite a few of us who are carpet python aficionados, I think if they gave a, you know, a Maclot a try, I think there's a lot of people who'd actually, you know, enjoy it. It's like, you got to get out of your mind that it's, you know, things like the value of the snake, you know, and the commercial demand, it's like, just ignore that. I mean, it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, that has no bearing on whether something's cool or not and stuff. It's like, you know... And just, you know, keep what you like. And I think people, I think there's a lot of, and it's, you know, we were going to talk about, you know, doing this full time for a living, at, you know, at a professional level and stuff. And that's another, you know, kind of advice for that as well. Work with what you like. The first thing, if you want to breed snakes for a living, and let's face it, a lot of herpers, that's the persistent daydream, but someday they'd like to do it for full time. And while there are always those people who will tell you that's impossible, oh, you can't make a living at this, and it's like, well, I can tell you that's not true because I've been doing it for a number of years now, and it gets better each year, not worse. So it certainly is possible. It's not necessarily something that everybody could probably do or should do, or, you know, not a lifestyle for everybody, but it's certainly not impossible. But I would say the first thing and foremost, figure out what you really legitimately, genuinely like and work with that. I think there's way too many people in our hobby, and we all see it, and maybe we say something, maybe we don't, but we all see it, and there are people who are just endlessly chasing around, spending money, buying snakes, trying to figure out what to make that they think other people will like.
Right.
And stuff, instead of really focusing on what should matter and what is that they like, what are they passionate about. That's what you should be working with, what everybody should be working with. Chasing after what you think the next big thing is going to be never really worked for anybody. You know, or rarely does that work. And at the end of the day, it's like, you know, you're the one who has to clean up its crap every day. Yeah. Most of, while being a professional snake breeder might on some level sound glamorous and you get to do what you love for a living, it's really a lot of picking up poo, really. That's the bulk of it is picking up crap. And, you know, at least if it's something you legitimately like and you genuinely are interested in, that makes that part of it a lot better and stuff. You got to be genuine, and you know if you're talking to a customer and they want to buy, you know, or interested in whatever, you come across as someone that has just clearly bought this because you thought it was a good investment, and you're just trying to make money. That people can figure that out pretty quickly, and no one wants to buy something from that guy. It's like, you know, you want to buy somebody who knows what they're talking about, who's passionate about what they're
right.
working with. And that's kind of contagious. Like, if you're talking to somebody and you can just tell that they are super into whatever it is that you're talking about, you can totally tell. And you can tell that they have a genuine enthusiasm. They're really into it. And you can – that's what gets you excited. It's like, man, that sounds so good. I want some of that, one of those, you know,
yeah.
whatever. Rather than just like, well, you know, I think the market's going to be great on this, you know, Balmore for whatever next year. So I'm getting, you know – I don't know. I mean – it's, I don't know. I think if people, you look at the mix of what's produced in our hobby, species-wise, even morph-wise, whatever, and I think if everybody really just worked with what they legitimately really liked and really, the species they really like to work with themselves, I think we would see a far different mix than what we currently see, don't you think?
Oh, yeah.
Right.
A lot of decisions are made based on what the perceived value or future value of this or that will be, and nothing wrong with making money, I mean, I've met anybody that didn't like money on some level, at least. I mean, there's certainly nothing wrong with, you know, making money from your hobby or your business or whatever. That's all fine. It's just like, it's just kind of a sad commentary if that's the only thing that matters, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you could probably be successful with this breeding anything as long as you're, you know, you just got to figure it out. It's rule number one, work with what you like. Don't work with because other people tell you it's going to be worth a bunch of money, because that never works out.
No.
Markets fluctuate. Prices generally go down. They rarely. When was the last time you saw a price go up on something over time? It usually just goes in one direction and that's down. You know, it's, you know, so all of that, endlessly trying to worry about markets and all this and that, it's like better just to find out what you really love to do and figure out how to make that work for you. And stuff,
mm-hmm.
because then regardless of whatever the market conditions are, you're still working with something you love.
right.
And stuff. And you can certainly make a living doing it.
So, like, when you're thinking about, you know, you obviously we all like carpet pythons. You know, do you think that you can make, well, obviously you do, but you also work with different species. So is that something that you have to think about when you want to do it full time?
Say my advice to anybody would be don't overly specialize. You see a lot of people that are, you know, specializing in ball pythons or specializing
mm-hmm.
in, you know, whatever. Well, it's like, well, if this is your job and you need to pay your mortgage based on that, if you specialize in one narrow niche, what happens when that niche goes in the crapper market-wise, as has happened with, you know, the ball pythons on two occasions now where they have massive declines across the whole sector? It makes it very difficult because your overhead tends to stay the same. But what you're producing all of a sudden loses 70% of its value. And that happens with alarming frequency and stuff. And, you know, you'd never go to a financial advisor and tell them, it's like, well, I've got, you know, $10,000 to put in my retirement account. What are the advice they give you? You're never going to hear the words, put it all in one stock. You know, they always tell you to diversify. You know, why would you, you know, any savvy investor is going to have some diversity in what they're invested in, and why would you invest all of your snake money into exactly all into one thing? Then you're wholly dependent on the market conditions for that one thing, and that's you find yourself extremely vulnerable, and particularly with morph stuff. It's kind of the allure of chasing after easy money, I guess. Oh, you know, all I need is one of these, and then I'll make a million of them, and it'll, you know, it seems like an easy road to riches, but it rarely works out that way.
Mm-hmm.
For most people anyway. And stuff. So I would say diversify. Don't work with anything you don't like. I mean, if you really look at, if you're into Python, there is a lot of different Pythons, and most of them are awesome.
Right.
I'm fortunate in that I can have a lot of different things because I like a lot of stuff. I don't work with any snakes I don't like. I will not work with things I don't like. I don't care what they're worth. I just don't do it. I mean, you touched on the hybrid thing and stuff. I'm sure I could, you know, earlier in the monologue portion of the show, I mean, I'm sure I could probably make more money if I were to cross things, but
right.
I don't, because it's just not, I'm not into that. That's not my thing and stuff. So I forego doing that every year, probably to my financial detriment, but I mean, I just don't, I stick to my own personal guns in that regard and stuff. And that's, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And it works. So Do what you love to do, and don't let anybody tell you to do something that different. I mean, figure that out. The rest of it is just like, it's just math. It's, you know, obviously it's different in different parts of the country. Cost of living and, you know, your own personal overhead and stuff is varies tremendously from person to person. But it's surprising if you do the math, it's really not that hard. It's not the kind of thing where you're going to become a millionaire probably breeding snakes, but there are more important things than becoming a millionaire, in my opinion. I mean, I get up, and when I go to work every day, I get to do what I love to do, and that's what I do for a living.
Right.
I love my job, and if this job paid nothing, I would still be doing it because it's what I do. So the fact that I'm fortunate to make a living doing it is a great thing. It's makes you a lot happier, you know, over, you know, other parts of my life when I was working for other people doing other things and stuff. You'd have a lot of bad days at work where you're really just thoroughly miserable.
Yeah.
Doing whatever.
Yeah.
We've all had those and stuff, but there's
yeah.
no, you know, I don't have those. I mean, there's obviously ups and downs with everything, but at the end of the day, I'm consider myself to be very fortunate. But it's an achievable dream. Most people, I think, could probably, you had to be, you know, pretty diligent about budgeting and stuff, because it's, by the very nature of it, snakes tend to breed in a breeding season, and you get a big cluster of, you know, hatching and babies, and then you get, you know, long periods with not much. There's different, just like the breeding season, kind of there's a cycle that goes along with that where you hatch all your stuff over a period of a few months, and then you kind of coast until the next breeding season, and, you know, sales are cyclical as well. Right now, in the middle of January, you ask anybody in any industry, it's usually the slowest time of year for sales for everything.
Hmm.
Yeah.
You know, everybody's
yep.
broke because they spent too much because of Christmas, and they spent too much at Christmas. It's they being broke from Christmas, and it stays this way until people start getting tax returns back.
Yeah.
It's not that nobody buys anything. It's just that across the board, it's the slowest time. And, you know, if you're doing this for a living and you've got bills to pay and stuff, you kind of, it can be feast or famine, so you need to be really good at budgeting. When you have really good times, you know, don't spend all that money because you're going to need that to get you through the lean times, which are, you know, right now and stuff. So being, you can make a lot of money in a week, and then you can go 2 months without making a penny. And that's hard for some people. There are people, I guess, who have a hard time with, like, if there's money in the account, they're spending it. You know, you've got to kind of, you know, another bit of advice I would, before I quit my day job and decided to take the plunge, I planned it out for a year and a half, so it wasn't a spontaneous or rash decision at all. I paid off all my personal debt. I owed no debt to other than my mortgage. I was completely debt-free. I saved up a considerable kind of an emergency fund because, you know, at some point you'll be like, your entire year's worth of income is in an incubator. If those
yeah.
guys don't hatch, you don't make any money. What happens if you have a power outage? And you lose an entire
cool.
year's worth of eggs. It's like you have no income. And, you know, while I think it's the greatest job in the world and I'm happy every day that I get to do that, the benefits package sucks. I mean, you don't get it's like there's no health care benefits or any of the other stuff. I mean, it's like you're kind of on your own for that stuff. So having money set aside to get you through, I know I've talked to Eric about it. When I put up a snake building, which is kind of the ultimate, if you're a herper, to have, you know, from having a snake room to a whole building. That's pretty awesome. But there's a pretty steep learning curve with a building. It's much more difficult than a room in a house and stuff. And there was a couple major design flaws with my building. So it didn't heat and cool properly. I had a couple really awful years. That, and we had like this freaky weather where it was the warmest winter ever recorded in 116 years. It was the least snowfall ever recorded. It's like we had a year with no winter. It just didn't, and I had over-insulated the building because it's normally very colder, so it wouldn't cool off, and it just, eventually it took me a couple years to get it all sorted out. But the point was only that during those first few years, I did horrible. I had 2 years of just like, 1 year I think I only produced 82 babies the first year, 82, which is nothing. You know, and not even an awesome 82 babies either. It was like not even like the best 82. But, you know, having that money I'd saved up in advance of that and everything, you know, really helped get me through that that year until I got things worked out. And I had to tear a whole wall off of this building completely off and rebuild it. I had to redo the entire heating system. I mean, it's, you know, it's a big complicated machine, and it was a little more difficult than I thought it would be to get it all working right. So having some money set aside is really a good idea, because you never know what's going to come up. And, you know, having that that little bit of a slush fund there really will get you through. That's probably a good philosophy for life in general, but if you're self-employed in any capacity, it's becomes really important.
What about as far as, okay, let's assume that you're working with the, you know, snake that you like to work with. What are some tips maybe for putting the collection together, like, you know, having backups of certain things? I mean, if you're invested in a project, for instance, with me, I have, you know, we talked about it before, I have an albino jag. What I've found, what I've learned the hard way is that, you know, it's better to have the visual male than a het, you know, and I should have just bypassed that and went straight to getting the visual male, you know. Any tips you
can... Well, that's the situation where you're talking only applies to morphs and stuff, but, you know, even if you're just breeding a species and stuff, having a backup plan, if you're doing this for a living, you need to, as a hobbyist, you would like to produce, you know, X, Y, and Z. It would be really great to produce this, that, or the other thing. You don't actually need to, because you typically have a job that pays your bills. Once you, you know, do this full time, you need to produce at least a certain amount because you have bills to pay, and that's where the money's going to come from. So it becomes more important and stuff, obviously. I like having a backup for everything. Usually I will go into the breeding season and I will have, you know, here's plan A, but I also have a plan B or even a plan C. Oftentimes that, you know, involves having an extra male of whatever. So most projects I've got, a large number of them, I'll have more than one male in that project. I'll have two males that are usually the same thing, just because if one doesn't get you, the other one will. And sometimes you end up, you know, sometimes a male doesn't want to breed. You're really kind of out. You're really not even going to get out of the gate with that, you know. Sometimes it's not possible because things are either this year. I mean, I'm having a couple problems this year with a couple first-year males that aren't really wanting to do anything for me. It's not over yet. I tend to start cycling late, so it's not over. But it ain't looking good for a couple things. You know, and if there's only one male, it's like, well, that's you're out of luck.
Right.
In my case, a lot of times it's if you have something that's very rare or unusual, or you know, the reason I might not have another male is because there just isn't another male to have. You couldn't get one, or it was, you know, just far too expensive. So it's not always necessarily possible or feasible financially or even physically possible in some cases to do that. But whenever it is possible, having a solid backup plan is often the difference between, you know, success and failure. This year I'm breeding trying for exanthic coastal carpets and exanthic jags. I have 2.2 of everything, you know, and sure enough, I've got a male that doesn't want to breed. Don't know why. He's producing sperm. Everything's great. Just doesn't want to do anything. But the other, if it was all on him, you know, if it was all on him, I'd be pretty much out of luck. But I have two, so I've got plan B, and the second male has bred both females, and I will, you know, I expect that I'll produce from that. So oftentimes there's really no excuse for not having an extra male around or two anyway, because they don't need to be very big. They don't eat much. You know, bigger animals, like, you know, bigger females and stuff are, you know, is a little bit more to consider. But with males, having a solid plan B, you know, in the case of the morphs, it's like, well, you know, you might like your albino male to be the sire of all these things, but, you know, maybe, and if you can't afford another albino, maybe just having a head albino, because, you know, I'll tell you what, getting a clutch from head to head is a whole lot better than getting nothing.
Yeah.
Using, having, like, it's like, you might not want to, you might be looking at that albino male and you might be really bummed he isn't doing it for you, but if you've got, at least got a head male, you've got a something. I mean, it's, you know, having
right.
no backup, you know, you end up with a, and it's biting me a couple times. I mean, I'll produce plenty of babies this year, but I'm going to have about 7 clutches I have no way to get because there's only one male for this project, and that's it. And, you know, if he's not going to do it, then it's just going to be, you know, wait until next year and trying again. So that's another part, I guess, of doing this for a living. You need to kind of assume that not every, we all know this, not everything goes every year, and not everything goes the way you want it to go, and, you know, it's you need to kind of plan for that. It's like, you know, I might try, I think last year I had 27 clutches of carpets, which is a lot of clutches. Now, they're not all big clutches. In fact, most of them were small clutches where they all, you know, they weren't 100% full eggs. I mean, it ended up being a lot of babies. But it's, you know, I tried, there were more than 27 females I put through the paces. I think I probably tried 32 or 33, and I was a little surprised that 27 of them went. I was figuring it wouldn't be quite that many. But you need to kind of build a little bit of wiggle room in there.
What about far as being a breeder, you go and you breed? I think probably the hardest thing for me is letting go of the babies. Do you have any?
Mine not. They go. Bye.
I'm
bye,
awful at that. Are you asking me that? I mean, that's not a problem unique to you or I. I think that's herpers in general. If you love what you do and you like this species or whatever it is, you naturally, it's like, wow, I just made a whole bunch of free babies. I'm just, you kind of want, there's this instinctive desire to hoard this stuff. But, and I've certainly succumbed to that. I literally, it was probably a month ago, and I was looking at all my holdbacks from this year, and I just thought to myself, so what in the hell am I doing? Like, what am I even doing? Why did, I mean, I don't even know why. I was to held back like 35 babies. I'm like, there's no mathematical way that, you know, when these things are all adults, I don't know what, I mean, it's just physically impossible. I was like, I can't get rid of them. I need this. And I can always, in every case, you can always make that really good argument to yourself why it was absolutely necessary. I typically, for holdbacks, nothing will frustrate you faster than selling something and then later on seeing the best one in the clutch, you sold it like a failing and then didn't keep it. I've more than once bought back animals I produced at a great expense because I should never have sold them. I'm breeding an ivory jungle right now and a Simpsons python that are both like that. And I'll tell you, when you sell something to somebody at one price and then they raise it all the way up and then right as it's ready to breed, you want to snatch it back from them, they make you pay.
They
will make you pay. And these are, you know, in those, both those cases, people I knew well. But I had to pay them a lot to buy back something I could have had for nothing because I just was too dumb to keep it, you know. But
yeah,
such as it is, usually with holdbacks, I'll hold back a group. You know, I'll keep back 6 3-point. I want to keep a pair. I'll keep back 3.3, and then I'll just kind of whittle it down, you know, over a year or something and stuff, and that tends to better your odds and stuff, unless it's something you can immediately, you know, you're zeroing in on this characteristic that's really obvious at hatching, but just general kind of color and stuff is oftentimes difficult to do that. You always hear people say silly things like, oh, I'm going to keep the whole clutch back and see how they turn out. It's like, you ever done that? I kept a whole clutch of ivory jungles back in, I don't know, 98 or something like that. It was 2007. I don't know where I got 98 from. It sucked. It's like, I was so sick of feeding those things. Like, it was like all these babies like for a year before I made the kind of the cut as the one I wanted to keep. It really stunk. So don't ever tell yourself you're going to keep a whole clutch back because you don't know what to do with them because you'll get real sick of it. Even if it's things you like, I'm like, this is a lot of babies that I don't know what I'm doing with. Even this year, the default setting is if I don't know what to do with it, I just end up not even trying to sell it. I've got a couple of weird caramel jags. They're just bizarre. I don't even know what to think of them, but I'm like, well, I don't really, I don't know what to do with these, so they just end up sitting around, and I keep feeding them, and eventually I'll have to make a decision.
But, now, the thing that I would think, I don't know, you would probably, you both of you guys would probably know this more than me, but take jungle carpets, for example. Nick, you've probably sold a fair share of jungle carpets. Don't you think they sell better at a year of age?
Yes.
Or,
Yeah, but I mean, I would never want to. I would never want to start off just like, you know, I start trying to sell them once they're feeding well and, you know, and ready to sell. But I find that typically what ends up happening, they really don't start moving until they've shed like 3 times and the color starts creeping in even a little bit. And then the more color creeps in, the faster they sell. And then they sell really easily. But, you know, I don't want to be breeding snakes and having to raise them all till they're a year old. I mean, sometimes that happens.
Right.
I mean, like this year, I've got, you know, on normal jungles, it broke really male heavy on the, I didn't produce a ton of normal jungles, you know, maybe 20, but out of all that, and, they're 2 to 1, they're male, so you're going to be sitting on some extra male jungles, and I know it'll happen from years past, the females will sell out quick, and then the males will be sitting on some yearling males, and by the time they turn yellow is about the time they'll sell.
Right.
But, you know, that's kind of now that I do this full time, my goal is to, since I know and it is my plan to produce a fair number of babies every year, I want to sell all the babies from 1 year out before I hatch more. I don't want to have 2 years or 3 years worth of babies sitting on the shelf, because every time they eat, I mean, you've got to, food costs money and your time and space, and you don't want to keep these things around forever. So I try to sell a year's worth of snakes over the course of a year. And if I can do that or pretty close to it, I'm on track. This year, in 2012, I had just a ludicrous number of babies, more than I've ever produced in a year, just shy of 400, and that's a lot of baby snakes. Sales have been great. I don't know. I mean, the economy might be bad for a lot of people, but I tell you, for reptiles, it's not too bad, man. I mean, I've got a lot of babies to sell, but I've sold more babies already than I typically would have produced in a year. So I have 120 left or whatever, but it's like, well, that's like 120 left out of like 370 something. So that's it's all relative and stuff. So, and I've still got a bunch of really good stuff. So, you've got to be willing to, if you're going to do it for a living, you got to be willing to house things and feed things for a while, unless you're just going to wholesale everything. I mean, I think people a lot of times have, not necessarily when they breed for a living, because usually they figured it out before then, but when they first produce their first baby snakes, I think a lot of people have it in their head that if all they do is hatch these babies out, then people will somehow blaze a trail to their door and line up to buy them. And that's obviously
right.
You guys breed snakes. You realize, like, selling snakes is a whole different activity than making snakes.
Yes.
You know, keeping and breeding the snakes is one thing, typically the funner part, but, you know, marketing and selling them and, you know, maintain them until, the moving them out and stuff is a whole other side of it, and it doesn't do you any good if you're very good at one. If you're not any good at the latter, you're not going to go very far. So if you can make all the things you want, if you're not very good at selling them, they're just going to pile up and eat you out of house and home.
Right.
So you need to, you need to get out there and really get after selling them and stuff. But there's every year, I mean, you always hear the kind of the negative Nancy's out there talking about, oh, the market's the crapper and everything's cheap and no one will buy them and no one's buying carpets. And like, I don't know. I just quit worrying about it. I just don't even worry about it. I don't even, you can't do anything about like kind of the macroeconomic side of things. All you can do is control what you're doing and don't even worry about the stuff you can't control. Every year I always think like, how am I going to sell all these babies? And every year they all seem to go somewhere. How many I produce, they always seem to go somewhere. So I just don't even worry about it anymore. And I never wholesale anything. I don't think I've never wholesaled anything. I sell them all person to person or whatever, and they all eventually go somewhere. So I don't even worry about it. I put in an effort to sell them too. It's not just waiting around for the phone to ring.
One of the things that I learned from you, Nick, is I think a lot of people don't realize this, is that if you want to sell snakes, people have to know who you are. You know, you can't just
tell you it sure helps.
The
amount of money people invest in any given snake, it's all relative. I mean, it's,
right.
Like, some of us, Eric and maybe to some extent myself. I mean, it's like it might not be that big a deal to spend a what would be deemed a large sum of money on a snake or two or what have you. But, you know, most people, you know, there's people at all different socioeconomic levels of this, and it's like, you know, what, well, a $200 snake is not really any kind of a big deal for me at this point. It's like for some people it might be. So whenever anybody's thinking of getting off of some of their hard-earned money, it's like, while it might not seem like a much, you know, a large amount to any particular one person, to the person that's money it is, it might well be, you know, a lot of money and stuff. And so where name recognition comes in, you know, the, you know, and reputation, having a reputation established and stuff. I mean, it's a lot of times you get people who've never bought anything on the internet before, snake-wise, and had something shipped to them and stuff. And that's a little bit, you know, the I'm going to give you this money, total stranger, and I'm going to trust that you're going to send me this snake. I mean, that seems a little, that's, you know, to some people that can be unnerving, particularly at first and stuff. And if they, if you have no, at least if they're, you know, kind of a known commodity in the hobby and in the industry and stuff, and people know who you are and they've heard of you and they've, there's good references for you out there. It's reassuring, and, you know, that is very helpful, particularly with more expensive stuff. You know, if you're selling somebody a, you know, a $5,000 snake, they might want to know who they're dealing with. And, you know, having an established reputation and those kinds of, and a good name in business and stuff certainly helps that. I mean, we all know, I mean, not without naming any names or anything close to that, but, I mean, there's certainly people I know I would buy a snake from. I know if I wouldn't buy a snake from, and I'm sure we all... You know, you say that, and I'm sure everybody who's listening to this all just thought of somebody. It's like, oh, I know a guy I wouldn't buy a snake from. We all know people like that. So, you know, I mean, if you're a straight shooter and you're, you know, you're doing things the right way and everything, having having some name recognition and getting your name out there in whatever capacity is helpful.
Right.
Stuff. So, I wish I would have been the guy who thought of starting a radio show. That was a good one. That was a good one.
Yeah, good job, Eric.
I'm like, I talked to Eric about this a couple of years ago. I'm like, then he goes and starts a radio show. I'm like, that's a stroke of genius.
Yeah.
Everybody knows who Eric Burke is.
Yeah, I'm tapped out now. I got no more left.
My other pet peeve, if you're going to be a professional reptile breeder, don't, when you, inevitably we all end up on various internet forums and such and stuff, don't have your screen name be something stupid. That's another tip. Have your screen name be your actual name.
Your freaking name.
It's like, because if you post some awesome picture and, you know, some great specimen or some really insightful wisdom or experience that's helpful to somebody, and they can't attribute that to anybody because your name is something ridiculous, you know, it's
Eric.
Having, you know.
Yeah, it's. I remember this is the first time I got, you know, my first shipment in from Paul Harris, and Eric comes in, and Nick calls me up, and he's like, Eric, you need to change your screen name from what the hell is it, Burke Filla to...
what does that even mean?
What is that?
To Eric Burke. He's like, what kind
of... Well, imagine if, like, no one would... Hey, you post great pictures of cool snakes and, you know, good advice for people getting into the hobby and all that stuff. If they can't attribute that to anybody, you've, you know... Not to say that the only reason you would make such posts would be for shameless self-promotion, but it's like, you know, if you... It's not a bad thing that people know who you are, and no one will know who you are if you're you're hiding behind a screen name,
right?
And stuff. So, you know, I'm Nick Mutton on every forum I've ever been on. So you'll know who you're. Plus it's just kind of frustrating when you're talking to somebody and then they email you or something, like you're supposed to know what their screen name is for some other forum. It's like, I don't know who these people are. It's like, just use your name, and everybody will know who you are. And I don't know. Maybe I'm just getting to be a curmudgeonly old man, probably. I'm totally going to be the, you kids get off of my lawn. I'm going to be that guy.
I was having way too much fun at the Hamburg show that I split the table with Ben and Aussie Addiction.
With who?
With Ben from Aussie Addiction.
Oh.
Yeah. So we split the table, and everybody who comes up, he's got the carpet python books sprayed out, and he's like, oh, I'm... Dr. Ben, you know, I wrote the one chapter in here, and then they go, oh, and you are? I'm like, oh, hi, I'm Nick Mutton. How are you doing? And I wrote the whole book. It's great. So I'll sign it for you. And then, like, you know, people
I would
do
that.
No,
someone would probably punch you in the face or something. You know.
I was waiting for the you son of a bitch. And like, oh, no.
Yeah, exactly. That son of a bitch.
Yeah.
Now Ben's a good guy.
Oh, yeah, you're having a blast.
Now, I love doing shows. That's another great part about doing this for a living. It's like, oh, I get to go justify driving away and doing all these shows and flying off here and there. And it's something great about, like, going to being a vendor at a reptile show, because it's like you're part of the cool kids kind of club at that point. Different than being on the other side of the table. It's like you get to be there before and after and hang out with everybody, and it's kind of a social yeah. aspect of it. It's a lot of fun. And plus, you get to just geek out with your own people for like a weekend. No judgments.
Oh, yeah.
It's like a whole bunch of like if I start talking about some snake-related thing for more than 15 minutes, my wife will just shut me down. Just shut
yeah.
it down. You guys laugh because your wives probably do the same thing to you, too. They just shut it down because they just don't care. But, you know, you go to the reptile show, you can be like the, you know, the king of the nerds there, and everybody is totally into it. You can talk snakes and look at snakes all weekend, and you don't got to feel guilty or like you're a nerd or anything. You can just kind of embrace it, you know?
Right.
I love
and
it.
Just go with it. It's awesome. What?
I love it. It's the cool kids table.
It is the
yeah,
cool kids table.
Finally.
I mean, you ever go to, like, Daytona? It's the funnest part is not looking at the show. It's going out to, like, the bar or whatever, the restaurant with everybody afterwards. You're just, like, a bunch of nerds talking nerdy stuff no one else in the real world gives a crap about. But, you know, it's like just you're into it. It's, you know, other like-minded people and
awesome.
Stuff. So there's that part of it's really I can't wait to get to Portland, Oregon here on Saturday and see old friends and hang out and be a nerd.
Cool.
Remember when it was like embarrassing to be a nerd? Now I'm just like embrace it, man. That's
yeah.
really
I
just go with it, man. It's like I'm into it. I'm gonna be the king of the nerds or something. I'm a nerd on a whole lot of other levels other than just herpetoculture. I'm like extremely nerdy in a lot of things. You know. All the in fact, everything that interests me, you define as nerdy by definition, probably. So,
awesome.
Yeah, but yeah, we are who we are, man. Why should we hide it? Just let
yeah.
our let's let it fly.
I got a question coming in from the man himself, Paul Harris at UK Pythons. He
oh
wants,
man!
Oh.
Really? What is
yeah.
he
oh,
doing
Jesus.
Up?
Yeah. Oh Jesus.
Me and him.
Or is he just? He's
yeah,
a
he's
night out. What?
The show. He wants to know if you're coming to Ham. And with the Antaresia book?
The Antaresia book just went to the printer. It's they print what's called the blue line, which is like they print a copy of the book on paper, just one side, not bound. Looks like a phone book, a big giant stack of papers, so you can see it
right.
actually in print. And that's like the drop-dead last chance of do anything, speak now or forever hold your peace kind of thing. And this time, Justin, I got to do that for the carpet book. Justin's doing it for this book. So I'm officially done. I just gave my blessing to the final version of the dust jacket about an hour before I called you guys up. So it's off out of my hands. So I think they're going to try to have it by March, in time for the March Tinley show. It's
awesome.
As usual, it's always going to be like a tight kind of will it get done in time and printed, because, you know, just when you send it off to the printer, it's not like they have other things they're printing. You have to wait in line. It's like, you know, they put you on the calendar when they're going to try to get it done and stuff. So, I don't know. I would certainly like to go to Ham. And anybody else that's, if you ever thought about going to the Ham show in Germany, that is a treat. If you could imagine,
really?
Like, almost too much reptile show, like, you wouldn't think it'd be, you could have that too much of a good thing. But it's almost that. It's like, it's so overwhelming, you can't even, it's really something and stuff. And plus, you know, most of us have been around the hobby for a while, you end up knowing a lot of people in Europe and other parts of the world, but you rarely get to, you know, be in the same room with them and stuff. And that's usually pretty fun, going out and hanging out with everybody and stuff. So,
cool.
Plus, if you do it for a living, then your wife can't get mad at you. That's a business expense, baby.
Yeah, there you go.
See, I'm networking with all these people I know over here. This is a legitimate business expense, and, you know, that's, at least that's how you sell it to them anyway.
That's a good point.
That's how I got to sell it. So, yeah, in answer to Paul's question, yeah, I probably should try to make it over. It's four times a year, so I was thinking of going over for the March one.
Okay.
Maybe the one
too.
After. March is shaping up to be pretty busy. I got a couple speaking things to do and stuff. So.
Oh, cool. He's saying that he wants you to sign the book as a guest at UK Python's table. So I think if you guys
well, if
are
I'm going to be there, I'm going to have to be at his table. It's not like he's going to let me be anywhere else. I mean, it's
yeah.
So, Owen, it
oh,
sounds
yeah.
like me and you might be traveling to Ham, because if we got Paul and Nick at
if
one
you
table.
If you want to go to Ham, that'd be
oh,
fun.
Sweet.
Get
oh, my
the,
God.
Get to the big tour.
God damn it.
I tell you, you know, like, you go to a lot of these American shows and, like, oh, and you hear, like, well, some of these guys, they really party after the show and stuff. Those Europeans are crazy. Like, I couldn't even, I don't drink or anything, but these guys are out of freaking control. Like, just mayhem. Like, they're just, yeah, it's, yeah, there was, it was, I wouldn't even, I couldn't even, it wouldn't be, to tell you the stories, it wouldn't, you couldn't put it on the internet radio even. It's just, it's just nuts.
Is it like that movie Beer Fest where they open the door and you go, like, down underneath some, some,
oh, man. Well, it's like after the show, because the ham show's only one day, and then you're, you know, you go out for a big steak dinner, and then you go hit, you know, all the bars and pubs and all that, and just, oh, man, yeah. They
job.
go a little crazy with it. So no, it's a lot of a lot of fun. A lot of fun. I'd like to I'll make it back this year.
And Eric was telling me Tinley was out of control. So which those
yeah,
are
I've
fun
never been
get,
to Tinley.
Like,
I was actually I had
text messages.
I had a table for the 2011 show, and then or had some spot I was gonna you know split a table with Sean Christian and. And then the Australia trip thing happened, and I was like, well, I got the choice between paying money to go to Chicago or paying someone else paying for me to fly to Australia and go herping. Like, I'm doing that. So.
Yeah, I don't blame you there.
I will. I've got to make it to Chicago. I mean, I've known so many people in the business for so long, and a lot of them I've never even been in the same room with, so I'd like to fly away at least once a year somewhere and you know, meet up with some of these friends. I got a lot of, I got friends up in the Northeast. I've never seen these guys. I don't even know what they look like, but I've known them for 10 years and
wow.
stuff. And so that's, if I can justify the expense, or more to my wife, it's not even the money. It's more just like trying to explain to my wife why she needs to take a few days off of work and watch the kids while I go be a geek out with friends of mine in parts of the country. That's the harder thing. It's the monetary
yeah.
thing is the easy part. It's smoothing it over with the wife. That's the, it's oftentimes the hard part when she's always telling me, happy wife, happy life, or something like that. But
so true.
You guys
it
laugh because you
like
know
that,
it's true. You guys have probably heard all the same stuff.
Oh, yeah. Owen's not in that club yet. He's,
he's not.
He's a single 26-year-old. He is okay.
He's still living
oh,
the dream.
Oh, man. Just wait. Just wait.
Yeah. Which is great because now that we have the radio show, you guys can all hear firsthand when that shit hits the wall. So, but,
oh, yeah. Nah, it's
actually,
all just different. Enjoy this part of your life. The next part will, I mean, it's
of
just
course.
Different chapters and stuff.
It'll be over.
Look,
but actually, Facebook, Justin just put a picture of the complete children's python.
Yeah, it was like, I literally,
Facebook.
After we started the show, I emailed
yeah.
Russ Gurley, the editor, and said, is it okay if I, like, crop the front of the dust jacket off and post it, like on websites
yeah.
and such and stuff. And
oh,
I literally
awesome.
Got the go ahead to do that. What?
It looks awesome. Justin threw it up there, so now I can maybe breed my spotted python.
Yeah, that's just been done
know.
For the last couple of minutes too. That's a
yeah, it's just
yeah.
right there. It's cool.
There it is, man.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So we could, I wasn't all that thrilled with the name, the complete children's python, because it implies the book about children's pythons instead of about the whole genus. But the complete Antaresia didn't. It just like there was really no way to make it sound really. I don't know. Just that seemed awkward too. So. And since it was the children eye complex for a long time, that's what it ended up with. I get
oh,
outvoted
cool.
sometimes. So.
It happens.
Well, yeah, oh yeah. It's anytime you're working on a big project like that with other people, it's like it is a there's a bit of a committee kind of aspect to it and stuff. So I always get my ways. No, it's anybody that liked the carpet book Justin and I did, I think they'll like this. It's very much in the same vein. It might be slightly more in depth because there's fewer species to contend with, so you can be even more in depth and stuff. But
yeah.
very much you know, in the same vein. So,
so
I'm proud of it. I can't believe I actually managed to be involved with writing one book, and now it, you know, it's like everything else. You know, you first get into reptiles as a hobby, and you're all stoked to get, you know, whatever specimen of this or that. And then there's all these kind of, I don't know, not coming of age isn't really the right expression, but kind of, you know, moments and stuff as you transition to different things, and I remember, you know, getting my first snake or breeding my first snake. So then you got a snake room. It wasn't just some cages in the corner. It was a whole room full of snakes. So it was a snake mm-hmm. building, and then it was like, you know, it wasn't a hobby. Then you quit your job and you did it for a living, or, you know, you were the guy at the show on one side of the table, and then you transitioned to being the guy behind the table who's actually vending at the show, and I guess this is kind of a logical extension of that, where you go from being the guy that was inspired by all these great reptile books, you know, by the Barkers and, you know, and some of the, and, you know, Ross and Marchak and some of these guys who wrote some of the great reptile books that inspired me when I was, you know, daydreaming, looking at pictures in these books and everything, and daydreaming about this as a hobby and then and doing it for a living and all this kind of stuff. And then now to have gotten full circle to where I'm the person, you know, involved in writing the books and stuff, it's rewarding.
Awesome. Cool. So next is Lyasis. You're going to make the complete Lyasis?
Yeah, there'd be like three people who'd buy it. That's the thing. It's like
I'll buy it. I'm number two.
I would love to. It's like it would be... You have oftentimes very uneven amounts of data available to you in terms
True.
Of the raw data. And in the Lyasis, you'll find like just mountains and mountains of data on Fuscus and
nothing
very
on
little
it.
On anything else. Little or nothing on anything else. I mean, it's very, very scant in other areas and stuff. So it'd be harder to, you have to approach it a different way. Sometimes, in some instances, in the carpet book in particular, we, you know, actually interviewed people who had field experience with various forms and stuff to, you know, supplement kind of a lack in the published literature and stuff. So anything, you know, like in a license would be more difficult, and it's the, you know, we're not self-publishing these, so the publisher has to believe there's a, you know, a market for the book
right.
to justify printing it, because printing books is expensive, especially big hardcover ones and stuff. It's not a cheap proposition to do. So I don't know. I'd certainly like to write something on the Lyasis genus. I don't know what form that would take. A book would be really cool, but I don't know. Something. I know I'm not going to stop writing things.
Right.
I don't know what I like. I've concluded that I like being the guy who writes stuff. I like learning. And when you write a book that's super in-depth, you learn a lot of things that, you know, I would not have... You know, we scoured the earth for every mention of the Antaresia genus ever.
Mm-hmm.
And I think found everything, you know. So if we would not have gone that, you know, out of just curiosity, I probably would have, you know, read all those papers and learned all that stuff. So in doing research for a publication and stuff, it really does, it forces you to do that research, and you thus you learn stuff along the way and stuff. And I think I like doing that side of it. So I'll do something. I've got an article I'm working on now. And stuff, and that'll be, you know, later in 2013. Though I'm not sure whether I'll finish it with the data I have now, or wait till the results from this breeding season are in, and then to have a larger data set. I don't know, but
cool.
Yeah,
awesome.
Good stuff.
Lots of stuff. So
we are now recording, so we probably have about 10 minutes or 15 minutes or so. So.
what time is it? Oh, crap. Is it 8?
11 o'clock. Oh, yeah. 11 here.
8 there.
Well, you knew I was, you know, good at talking for a long time anyway.
Yeah, it's true.
I may not be good at anything else, but I am good at talking. I can never run out of things to say. Probably
that's
the time where I should stop talking and don't, but I'm...
Well, you know... You're like the perfect guest, Nick, because we don't have to ask you questions. You just kind of go to it. I love it. You know?
We don't prep at all. We just turn it on. Where's Nick? Go, Nick.
And it's interesting stuff. You know, I mean, yeah, you say it's nerdy stuff or whatever, but, you know, we're really into these. Yeah, exactly. So what shows are you going to be vending at in case you're in the – since we broadcast worldwide, you're over
I'll be – Typically, I vend only at every show in the Northwest. I mean, so there's a few in Portland and a few in Seattle. I actually thought about putting one in the town I live in, Spokane, Washington, of all places. So, which I guess I would do. I tend to not want to
maybe
I tend to not want to sell snakes in my own backyard just because people tend to want to. Oh, I can just come over. It's like. Well, that's
no,
not happening.
You can't.
So if they know I'm in the same town, then they'll think they can come over typically, and I don't really do that. But I don't know. I tend to only vend at the shows in the Northwest. My table display is really, really elaborate and is impossible to ship. Each display, of which there's nine of them, they all weigh about 50, 60 pounds a piece. Well, they're all made of like chrome-plated steel and polished aluminum diamond plate and etched glass, and it's just crazy. Because I used to do metal fabricating, and I like doing metal fabricating. I like doing that. I like grinding and welding and stuff. And so I decided to make the most ridiculously elaborate and impractical display one could possibly imagine. I've got one that's on a motor that rotates around, and you know, and it's really elaborate. It's really eye-catching and all that, but it looks great, and you know, every show, people just can't believe this display, and that's all great, except for it's impossible to move. If I can't drive it in a trailer to somewhere, then it's just not, you know, I can't go to take it to Tinley, so something like that would require me buying something that's a little more portable. Just these are just way too heavy and way too large to transport or fly anywhere, so.
Wow.
I don't know. I like going to those shows, but I actually don't know if I want to vend. I just like going and hanging out. To me, I have more fun. I sell snakes online just fine. And I do great, you know, when I'm at a show, I usually do really well relative to, you know, what's going on and what I brought and all that. I've never really had any complaints, but it's like, to me, like the funnest part about going to the show is I'm not looking forward to, I got to leave on Friday and drive 310 miles through crappy road conditions and snow, apparently, to get to Portland. And I'm not even looking forward to, like, all the money I'm going to make. I'm looking forward to seeing old friends and, you know, that are in the business and people are going to come by and hanging out, you know, and going out the night before. That's the funner part anymore than not so much, you know. If I find myself, like, where I'm just only, you know, I'm upset if I, you know, about the money and it's all about, you know, the money I'm going to make, then it's probably time to not do it anymore. It's like I really enjoy going to shows and seeing what's to see and hanging out and talking to people and stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's the funnest part. Usually I do make some money, but I mean, it's more, that's not why it's fun, I guess. At least not for me.
Right.
And stuff, so. But it stops being fun. It'd be time to maybe think about getting a day job or something. But so far, so good. I don't know. Almost 7 years now since I started doing this. Here I've been more successful than the year before, so it's, no end in sight.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
Good to hear. Anything else you want to hit on before we jump
actually,
off?
Paul's calling me on my other line. It's Paul.
Are you coming to him?
Yeah.
All right, well, we'll let you jump off and talk to Paul because I know I would want to talk to Paul rather than Owen and Eric, but.
Ow.
All right.
I guess.
So thanks for coming on the show, Nick. And when you when the book is out and you want to come on, we'd love to have you, Justin, like we talked about, and push the book there.
Probably try to get Peter on there, too. He's a character. You like Peter.
Sweet.
All right. Good talking to you guys. I'll talk to you again real soon.
All right, Nick.
All right, thanks, Nick.
Okay, bye.
There we go. Another awesome show in the books. Definitely.
That should be one of your drinking things. I'm sorry, buddy, but you said it like every show.
Do I? Well,
yeah.
I always find the ones with, you know, Nick and guys that they're very well-educated, very awesome
show.
The
problem with Nick is that we could have like a 24-hour show and we could still not even get past the tip of the iceberg of what he knows on the species that we brought him on for. I mean, until I ask this stuff, we ask him a question, he starts and he goes and he answers it, but then he goes like 25 steps further. And roundabout way leads us to five other facts and five other things about five different species. And we finally get back to the first species that we were talking about and goes, yeah, and that's why I keep them at 83. And we're like, what? Wait, what was the question I asked in the beginning? Because I'm like still reeling about the fact that you said like, oh, well, they broke off like 20 million years ago. And that's what happened. It's like, I'm like, what? Awesome. But wait a minute. Huh? So it's like you have to, with the Nick episodes, you have to re-listen to them in order to get, like, any of the information. You got to understand is that he could just keep going and going and going, and each tidbit of knowledge is just, I mean, the man must read way too much. I mean, I can't fathom it sometimes.
Yeah, my brain is going crazy because, My good buddy Paul Harris over at UK Pythons is messaging me as I'm talking to Nick on the show, and it's like, oh man, this is. Why don't you just call in, Paul?
Yeah, well, come on, Paul, do it, Paul.
Yeah. So
it,
cool.
It's okay, it happens, but it's just freaking awesome to have Nick involved with Carpet Pythons and in the community, and I totally agree with what he says, is that people don't give certain species a chance, and once you do, you find that you're just hooked, because honest God, I would have never, ever picked up any liasses until you dropped off that one at my house, and it snowballed out of control, because they are fantastic pythons. I love my Max to death. And then that led, of course, to the olives and to the waters. It's just something that you find interesting, and I always like the fact that we have over here at Rogue that we have these rare animals.
Yeah.
Not rare, just because of, like, you know, they're special or, you know, one of a kind. It's that people aren't really working with them because, you know, it's not that much of a market. But, you know, I brought the black-faced whitelet to a show and people were like, what the hell is that? And I'm like, really? You know what this is?
I think maybe the, you know, I think that, you know, the market is what you make it. I think that Nick kind of hit on a good point that, you know, if you're passionate about something, there goes that word, drink it up. If you're passionate about something, people pick up on that, you know, and they really dig it. And I think that makes people want to be involved in that. I think that just goes to, you know, you think about Steve Irwin and think about how he dealt with just reptiles in general. And, you know, people really... really, you know, they attached to that. They really embraced it, you know, and got them, whether they got a bearded dragon, a ball python, or a carpet python, it doesn't make any difference. But they, you know, they watched the show and they were like, wow, this is really cool. I think that, you know, hopefully that this show and other shows out there that do focus on the more rare species of pythons, you know, just to give them some spotlight other than, you know, it's a killer bee, Mojave, super blast, whatever. Yeah, I don't even know. Probably
I mean,
you know, or even, you know, albino zebra jag, you know. It's just, you know, that's cool and I dig it, but I also dig the other part of it, which is the species part of it. And, you know, the reason that I wanted to talk about the whole approaching it as a breeder is because, honestly, I like all pythons. I dig every single one of them, including ball pythons. There's some out there that I look at the picture of them and I say, wow, you know, that's really cool. I love, like, Mojave stuff and butter stuff. And then they start mixing it with this other genes, and they're cool. But I even liked when I had my normal ball python. You know, I remember when I was a kid and I would go to the pet shop and there it was sitting in the tank. And I was, you know, that was like the snake that I have. Wow, that's
I don't think
so
we can be friends anymore.
Oh, no?
Yeah, I don't think, yeah.
but the point is that, you know, I dig all the different types of species. You know, I would not, if I was doing this full time and it was my business, to me, I would be happy dealing with, you know, everything from retics to pygmy pythons, you know, because I just dig pythons in general.
Something cool on each thing.
Yeah.
I can understand that. And from working in the zoo, you had, like, I worked with a bunch of different species, and each one you like to a certain extent. They're not my they're not like my wheelhouse, my passion, if you will. It doesn't count for me, only for him. But I still enjoyed working with them. What's funny is that Chris, like, it almost seems like he just found his wheelhouse with the scrubs.
Right.
He's gone absolutely apeshit. Because, you know, I was texting you over the weekend. We just picked up Halmahera. And it's just like, what the hell? Dear Lord. Things I thought I would never have in anywhere near me. Halmahera, top of the list. So, surely a little bit below Bowens. Anyway, but it's just like, you know, it's the fact that now he's got all of them. And he's got drive when it comes to things. I haven't seen him get this excited about a type of python ever. Not even when he was just doing carp pythons. He was interested, but this is insane. If that's what he likes, it's what he likes. Which is why the olive pythons might be coming over here soon, because running out of space.
come over, let me know, and I'll be over to check them out. But yeah, I mean, like, there you go. Like, I often think about, honestly, I think about what carpet python I'm getting next. Am I getting this carpet python? Am I getting this carpet python? Or am I getting a Bolin's python or rough scale python or, you know, a scrub or whatever it is?
No, we already talked. You're not allowed to get roughies till I get roughies. I don't care what's on your list before it. You go Bolin's. You do everything else first. Don't touch the roughies till I get the roughies.
Right. But what I often struggle with is that, like, Sabus to me are the coolest of the liasses. You know, to me, I really dig them. I really like them. I there's just something about them. I just find them cool. So I would love to work with them. You know, blackheads. I really dig blackheads. You know, there's tons of pythons.
Right.
Tiger retics. I personally don't think I'll ever own a tiger retic, but to me,
I dig them. You start getting to like the purple, like golden child tiger albino. I mean, those look like phenomenal, and those are very pretty, but I just sit and I go, yep, eat my face, nope, thank you. So
and then, you know, even Burmese, I would love, you know, there's just crazy Burmese out there now too. Anyway, it's just my point is that if it was up to me, I would work with all species of python. Just carpets and Morelia just happen to be
Your favorite.
Yeah. That's my favorite of the group, but I love them all, and that's kind of the whole idea of the show. Is I don't know if we'll ever talk ball pythons on the show, but we mention them every once in a while. But
I'm gonna have to take a sick day if we do that. It's really
you
nice.
You know what it is? I think that the radio show, reptile radio show type of thing market is oversaturated with the ball python talk type of thing. You know what I mean? People do that already. So if I want to listen to that, I just listen to the show. We're trying to do something different. Exactly. You know, so everybody gets a taste of what's out there as far as python species go. But, anyway.
Right. Wow. Well, guess what?
What?
I'm looking in my caramel cage, and they are locked.
Caramel to caramel?
Super caramels, baby.
Oh, there you go.
I don't know why I'm whispering. I feel like I'm going to disturb them. Anyway.
Anyway,
I totally agree with that.
Isn't it pretty cool to sneak into your reptile room at night? And, you know, if you've been keeping reptiles for a while, it's like you sort of, you know, you graduate to these different levels of your keeping ability. And there's nothing cooler for me when I go in there at night and I'm peeking in the cage and I see, you know, the male sparring the female, and I'm like, oh, yeah, here we go.
I get an all-time high when I see babies pipping. The second I see heads coming out of those eggs, I am, yes. Because then the next couple of days are just spent, what's coming out now? What is this baby going to look like?
Yeah.
My old backs. Oh, my God, you look insane. It's okay.
It's even more cool. This is probably a coolest part of it, of having somebody else have your business with you. Because my IJ's hatched out, and it was my first clutch, and I dug it, and I was really excited about it, you know. And my wife came in, and she looked at it, and it was like, yeah, okay, cool. You can hatch snakes.
Thanks, woo. It's like,
woo-hoo. You know?
You're ruining this for me.
When we had the clutch hatch over at Rogue, you know, it came over, and there's me and you, and we're like nerding out, like, you know, ooh, take a picture.
Oh, yeah.
What is that?
Holy shit, that looks like a red zebra-like thingy. Yes, it does. Oh, my God. Yeah. This is exactly what it's like and what I imagine is going to be like. You know, if Chris calls me and says we got blackface, white lips, I'm pretty sure my car tires aren't going to touch the ground and until I am, like, ripping into his parking lot just so I can just see baby white lips, because that'll be – I'll be – oh, man. Oh, my God. But it's really funny because also Chris will yell at me. He's like, so we're doing super caramel, right? I'm like, yeah. Why didn't we do that last year? I wanted to do other stuff. Well, that was stupid. Shut the fuck up. Yeah, it's like, you know, I get it from all sides. It's not just you people on the radio and, you know, you darksiders pretending to, you know, upset me. I get it from all sides. Shut up.
How about that, the dark side?
And I have plenty of cookies, goddammit.
Yeah, I was going to say, the dark side.
I have many cookies.
Cool comeback with their Zach.
I couldn't think of anything. I asked, my sister used to work at a bakery.
Uh-huh.
up the street. And I actually asked if I could bring one of my jungles and put it on their, like, display and take the pictures and go, fuck you, we got cakes. But they said something about health code and that I shouldn't bring a snake among food. I don't know. So,
probably not a good idea.
Yeah, but it was going to be a very nice comeback, but I couldn't get it to happen. So.
Right. There you go.
I apologize.
But, we've been... they've been kicking ass pretty much with the comebacks, so I'm pretty happy with that.
Behoff has started, so I mean he's just gonna get everyone mad at him. So,
so yeah, that's cool. I guess what we will end with next week. Next week we have Singular Reptiles. It's Casper Christensen. I couldn't think of his name. Yeah, so he's calling in from Copenhagen, Denmark.
It's a whole new country.
And, you know, if you're into Scrubs, you might want to tune in because he keeps King Horneye. And not many people get to work with King Horneye. He has Bolins, carpets.
Don't tell Chris. Oh, King Horneye?
Yeah.
Yeah, we can't tell Chris.
Yeah. Well, he's going to be on next week, and he's going to be talking how things are over there, and
awesome.
Should be a good show. He's a real cool guy, and he's from Singular Reptiles, and you know, I've been talking to him since we started Morelia Python Radio, and you know, he's got a lot of information, and I you know, it just seems silly for me and him just to talk. I said, you know, you should come on the show. So looking forward to talk to him. Real cool guy.
Awesome.
What else do we have? I was just actually, as we were going back and forth, you're talking about Paul Harris. I just nailed him in to come on the show when his 2013 season has officially kicked off.
Cool.
So he'll be coming on and talking again about all the cool things that he has hatched out. And I was telling you the other day, in case you don't know, if you're into carpet pythons, Paul Harris is kind of like the king when it comes to carpet pythons in my book. He has pretty much everything you could possibly imagine. Now, he's over in the UK, but him and Nick Mutton have a deal worked out where they kind of import, carpet pythons from over in Europe over to here, and then Nick sends them out throughout the country. Because I got a pretty cool box that came in of some cool stuff, albino jag, which Nick tells me is pretty much orange. So I'm looking forward to seeing that. And it's breeder size. I think it's an 07. He says it's huge.
I hate you.
So hopefully I can get that before my breeding season is over. And maybe I can that was my backup. And we were talking about backups earlier in the show.
Yeah, backups are good.
That's my backup. So,
I'm kind of getting myself beat because I don't have a backup granite IJ, and I do not have a backup zebra jungle. If I had a friend who was like a IJ nutball and could somehow get me a boy or something to jumpstart my boy to do whatever, he would be greatly appreciated.
Yeah, maybe.
You son of a bitch. But
cool. But, Paul is UK Pythons. You should go over and check out his site, www.ukpythons.com, and you can see all the cool projects that he's working with.
Not just carpet pythons. He's got the silver savus. He's got the rough scales. He's got – I think he's going to take over the blackhead market in the UK very soon with the fact that I think he has every single type of blackhead morph out there. So.
Oh, yeah. He works with the hypos, albinos, exanix, you name it, he's got.
Yeah.
So that's cool stuff. So,
3D.
Go over and check it out. And, of course, there's Nick Button. He is Inland Reptiles, www.inlandreptiles.com. And Nick has
crazy stuff, too.
Yep. He pretty much has every kind of python you can imagine, I think. So that's cool stuff.
I meant to ask him about how his stonewash brettles were going.
Oh, yeah. We forgot about that.
Yeah.
Forgot about that.
I wanted to. Yeah. Oops.
Oops.
Well, we'll have to have him back on. Anyway.
Yep.
So,
I started a new thing real quick before we jump off. We probably got about 5 minutes, and I just wanted to hit this real quick. Over on the website. I was going to put it on Facebook, but I decided to put it on the website so that, you know, I got more traffic over there. But it's going to be Moralia Tip of the Week. Tip. Not pick. Tip.
Tip.
Basically, tip. Every week, either Owen or myself will give you a tip. And we won't tell you on the radio, so you have to go over to the site and check it out. So we'll just put it up there every Tuesday so you can check it out. And we'll, you know, you can get little tips and tricks that I have learned, Owen has learned. And if you have a tip or trick that you'd like to share with us, we will definitely put it up there and put your name on it and everything and give you the credit for it. You can email me at info@moraliapythonradio.com, you know, that should be cool, because I know Owen has given me a lot of tips, so
half the time it's just guessing, so it's okay.
You can go over and check us out at www.moraliapythonradio.com. And speaking of which, Owen, you got to send me some pictures of some of your snakes.
Oh, you know where the website is. Go get them.
I don't know where the website is. What is the website?
It's rogue-rep. You listen to me when I speak at the end of the show.
I was just trying to give you the plug. I was just trying to segue into.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Of course I know what your website is.
All right. It is rogue-reptiles.com. Definitely head out over there. We are, I posted up a bunch of babies for sale. And actually we're starting to sell some babies like hotcakes around here. I don't know what the hell's going on. We had 80 and I think we're down to 20 something. So, okay.
That'd be cool.
Anyway, I did post the website and I did go live with the website, but I forgot to put the form that everyone needs to fill out in order to inquire about a baby. So if you have been on the website before, go back, because now there is a form that you can fill out and it automatically email us with the information of a baby that you're inquiring about. On that webpage also we have the list of our upcoming shows. We have the one in Hamburg at the end of February where we will be splitting the table with Ben from Australian Diction. Bring your carpet python books. He said he'd be happy to sign them. Or if you don't have one yet, he'll have some there. It's great. Also, he'll have a ton of great-looking animals. I think also we have a few other shows coming up with Eric. You know, Tinley's right around the corner and a few other things, which reminds me we need to get a hotel room. Anyway, definitely go check out rogue-reptiles.com for all the listeners there. You can also check us out on Facebook, Rogue Reptiles on Facebook. That's all I got, I guess. So without any further ado, and I guess I don't think we have anything else, we'll just say thank you for coming by, good night, and we'll catch everybody next week for some more Moralia Python Radio.